You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Joseph Gerson. Dr. Joseph Gerson is just heading off to an anti-NATO event in Poland and has just authored an article called Imperial NATO, Before and After Brexit. Gerson is Director of Programs for the American Friends Service Committee's Northeast Region and Director of AFSC's Peace and Economic Security Program. He focuses on preventing nuclear war and achieving nuclear weapons abolition, education and organizing for peaceful and just alternatives to U.S.-led militarization of the Asia-Pacific, and prevention of U.S. wars, focusing most recently on NATO, Ukraine, and Iraq. His books include Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World, and The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of U.S. Foreign Military Bases. Joseph Gerson, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be talking with you.
Great to have you on here. NATO and Brexit. Does Brexit actually impact NATO in any way?
Yeah, I think, you know, there have been two forces that have essentially held Europe together. And one has been the European Union, which, you know, now is in, we have the specter of this possible dissolution. And the other is NATO, which has been holding it together really on more of a coercive basis. And I think what we're going to see in the coming year or more is going to be increased focus by U.S. And European elites on NATO as essentially their fallback against the problems within the European Union.
It's interesting you refer to NATO as holding Europe together. I hadn't thought of it that way. I just read a book that was promoted by the Stop the War Coalition in England about the European Union as a force for peace, as having held Europe together and prevented intra-European wars and facilitated peace in Northern Ireland and Northern Spain and so forth. Does NATO have some sort of a role in terms of uniting European nations and preventing wars between them?
Well, you know, preventing wars is a open question here. I mean, you've got the situation in Ukraine, you know, which was in fact in large measure created by the expansion of NATO to Russia's borders. But it's created an integration of European military forces. And, you know, the kind of militarist elite. So to that degree, it has, you know, sort of the military side of the unity as opposed to the more free-flowing democratic and economic. So you have, for example, within NATO now, Poland, which is where the summit is going to take place. And it's being ruled by an extreme right-wing nationalist government, which has been taking apart what they had of Polish democracy, stacking its Supreme Court, making it very difficult for the Supreme Court, in any event, to make any rulings, and now an assault on the media so that you know, really you can't have a free flow of discussion, debate, or news about what's really happening. So in that way, you've got a situation where NATO has functioned to reinforce right-wing forces. You also have, I mean, similarly, the role of NATO and our presence in determining the outcome of elections earlier in France and in Italy with a little bit of Kissinger manipulation back there in the 70s.
Yeah, so part of holding Europe together and exporting war from Europe to elsewhere. You mentioned a summit. We're recording this now on July 6th. You're about to get on an airplane. By the time it airs, this will have happened. But what is happening in Poland, both in terms of NATO and in terms of opposition to NATO?
Yeah, well, on the side of NATO itself, what you're going to see is a reaffirmation of its nuclear doctrines. You're going to see a consolidation of a decision to base more forces in Eastern Europe. The movement of the center of NATO east toward Russia, with the idea of reinforcing a hub for NATO in Poland. You're going to see demands from the United States for increased military spending, and essentially moving toward toward a higher war footing. On the other side, there's going to be an international conference, a counter-summit conference, which will bring together leading peace figures and scholars from across Europe and a couple from the United States, and a demonstration in the streets, which will be interesting. I have to say, we'll see. I hope the government will allow it to go forward. But it will provide an opportunity for us to, if you will, deepen understanding what NATO really is, and to build alternatives with a focus on the idea and the concept of common security, which is basically the paradigm on which the Cold War itself was ended. And we've moved away from the idea of common security and toward the kind of triumphalist vision of U.S. dominance.
Yeah, and I guess also by the time this airs, there will have been simultaneous NATO protests of some magnitude in New York and in Northern California. Is that right?
Yes, that's what I'm reading.
And how do you think awareness of and opposition to NATO in the U.S. compares to that in Europe? It seems to me there's much greater both awareness of what in the world's going on and visible opposition to NATO in Europe.
Yeah, so it's a day for night comparison. I mean, for Europeans, NATO has been present in the form of especially U.S. military occupation now for the better part of 70 years. It's been the focal point of militarization in the region and of anti-militarist struggles. Here in the United States, I think very few people know much about NATO. The propaganda that it was there to protect us from the Soviet Union during the Cold War, still lingers. And I think one of the important things, and one of the reasons I appreciate this program and interview, is the summit provides us with an opportunity to be educating people in the United States, to be going deeper to understand its roles in reinforcing not only U.S. control of Europe, but U.S. global domination. And in my article, I made reference to former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski and how he understood NATO, as well as other alliances. And it also helps us to both be talking about the nuclear roles of NATO, and to talk about common security alternatives. As our country is increasingly militarized and we're facing increasing dangers with tensions both with Russia and China, I think it's just critically important for people to begin understanding what common security is, to understand how it ended the Cold War before the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union. It's the idea that one nation can't be secure if its enemy or rival is insecure by what it does, and the need to do negotiations that respect the needs and interests of all sides.
NATO was not part of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Is that correct?
Well, you had it provided the foundation for winning British and French and other European, German role with especially with Afghanistan, but also Iraq. And you had a situation where, just to go back and to help educate your audience, when the Berlin Wall fell, there were negotiations between the United States and the Soviet Union as to on what basis Germany would be reunited. And Gorbachev, then the head of the Soviet Union, agreed that Germany could be reunited on Western terms, on the condition that NATO didn't move an inch closer to the Soviet Union or Russia. And from a Russian perspective, they have the deep historical experience and memory of absolutely devastating invasions from the West, Napoleon, the Kaiser, and Hitler. So this was the agreement. And the United States then, beginning with Bill Clinton, began moving NATO to Russia's borders. And so while on the one hand this helps to consolidate U.S. power on the Eurasian continent, the other And the other element here is that, as Don Rumsfeld said in the run-up to the Iraq War, it allowed the United States to play divide and conquer. So in his terms, the United States could play old Europe, could play new Europe, which is to say Eastern Europe, against old Europe in order to win old Europe's involvement in the wars. So that was part of the lever that the U.S. played in order to get especially French and British involvement in the war.
Yes, but some of the wars have more straightforwardly involved NATO from the start, including, I'm thinking, Afghanistan and Libya and, back in the day, Yugoslavia. I mean, what is the list of foreign expeditions that NATO has been on?
Well, you've got those that you have listed, but then you have the role of NATO in providing legitimacy for U.S. bases across Europe. So, for example, now AFRICOM, which is involved in daily warfare in Africa, is based at the Ramstein base in Germany. So you have this other function and role. You have the use of U.S. bases across the region to reinforce the U.S. Subversion and wars in the Middle East. The reinforcing U.S. hegemony in the region, really go back to 1949 or so. And you have, the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons there that have been used consistently to reinforce U.S. Middle East hegemony. I mean, most people think that the last time nuclear weapons were used was Nagasaki in 1945. But in reality, and as Dan Ellsberg teaches us, the U.S. weapons have been used time and again during crises and wars in the way that a robber, an armed robber, points a gun at someone's head. Whether or not he pulls the trigger, the gun's still been used. And so you've had U.S. nuclear alerts and the threats of U.S. first strike really going back to 1946, before Russia even had a nuclear weapon, but consistently on through. And recall that in the negotiations with Iran, both Bush the Lesser and Obama said, look, all options are on the table. When a nuclear power says all options are on the table, that includes nuclear. And a major part of that force are weapons and ships and so on based in Europe.
Yeah, and so we now have, as you mentioned, NATO expanding up to Russia's border, pushing for some sort of partial membership for Ukraine and Georgia as well, so-called missile defense bases in Romania and under construction there in Poland, and military exercises and the coup in Ukraine and more new nukes into Europe. I mean, talk about some of these exercises and expansions and how they look from Russia's point of view.
Right. So, I mean, one way to help people understand it is imagine, in northern Mexico, maybe 10 miles or so from the U.S. border in Texas, Russia is conducting military exercises with tens of thousands of troops, is putting in the most modern weapon systems that there are, has it all reinforced with its nuclear first strike nuclear threats. And you begin to understand that they feel besieged, which is not to be an apologist for Putin or his government, but to appreciate that, look, the U.S. Economy is, 15 times larger than the Russians. So you have a situation in which you've got, U.S., basically a new U.S. naval fleet in the Black Sea, which you can say is sort of the equivalent of the Caribbean, were Russia to be there. You have these massive military exercises. You've got air and naval operations up in the Baltic. So you have a situation which, Russia has its own degree of pride, its own fears, and so they're attempting to meet this in kind. And so you have increasingly dangerous confrontations in the midst of exercises on both sides. So as Michael Clare has written, and there's a trilateral group of scholars and security analysts called the Back from the Brink study group, who are saying, look, what happens if a frightened or overamped U.S. or Polish or Russian soldier in the middle of one of these intense confrontations decides he's had enough or is just too frightened and pushes the button on the missile he's got that takes down the warplane from the other side. Well, then you're into the thick of it with the possibility of escalation all the way up to the impossible and the unimaginable. Not that we're impossible. And you have a situation which in many ways is comparable to the years leading up to World War One. So people, a number of people make the analogy of a new Cold War, but I think it's better understood to be something like 1912 or 1913 in terms of the structural dynamics going on and the dangers that an incident could lead to just an unimaginable crisis.
Yeah, although with nuclear weapons, unlike World War One.
Exactly.
Yeah, the other thing I notice is how these incidents of Russian planes flying near U.S. planes in the Baltic or the Black Sea are described. I mean, I think if Russia had its ships in the Caribbean or off the coast of Florida and a U.S. plane were to fly somewhere near a Russian plane and Russia were to describe that as aggression against Russia, that would sound a little bit silly to us, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just to say there have been some excesses on the Russian side, too. I mean, you had a situation where one of their warplanes essentially did somersaults within 20 yards of a U.S. warship.
But not within any number of miles of the U.S. coast. Rather near Russia.
Of course. I mean, the reality is the Russians are sending their ships into other countries' waters. I mean, they've been doing it with Sweden. They've been doing it. They did that throughout the Cold War, and you've had some Russian ships in the neighborhood of Britain. So I think we need to say, look, the principal problem here is the United States and NATO. Russia is acting, if you will, largely defensively, but in ways that can be provocative, too.
For sure.
In this situation, it points to, I think, the necessity, the urgency of moving toward common security diplomacy to look at, step back from the brink, as the study has it, and find ways that we can coexist and build the more peaceful relations and not be diverting trillions of dollars away from our societies, which so badly need investment.
Yeah. When you say the United States and NATO, I mean, is NATO a tool of the United States, or is
it? Oh, absolutely. It has been from the beginning.
It's not some sort of coalition of equals.
Who's the supreme military commander? It's always a U.S. general, supreme commander of NATO. And the U.S. has a predominant role in selecting who's going to be the NATO General Secretary. Is always somebody from Europe, but has to meet U.S. approval. And with the military presence, which is principally U.S. across Europe, I mean, it's a U.S. alliance.
It also seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, a tool that facilitates U.S. militarism in a number of ways. In one way, it takes various atrocities out from under congressional oversight, were Congress to consider engaging in such activity, because they're labeled, NATO crimes in Afghanistan rather than U.S. crimes in Afghanistan. But it also seems as we're recording this on the day that the Chilcot Inquiry Report came out in Britain, and I'm reading through there and seeing that the British decided when they couldn't get a UN authorization to attack Iraq, they would go with the Kosovo method, meaning ignore Iraq, but establish some sort of coalition of more than one country and pretend that somehow legalized it and just go ahead without the UN. Does NATO serve these sorts of purposes for you?
Absolutely. It was interesting, back in 1999, after the war against Serbia, a guy named Michael Glennon, who teaches at Tufts University, had a very interesting article in Foreign Affairs, the journal of the liberal elite. And this is what he wrote. He wrote, "With little discussion and less fanfare, the United States has effectively abandoned the old UN charter rules that strictly limit international intervention in local conflicts in favor of a vague new system that is much more tolerant of military intervention, but has few hard and fast rules. So as we were discussing before, this then serves as the foundation, say, for the overthrow of the Gaddafi government in Libya, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and on it goes. So, you know, while we have, I mean, I think one has to have a sense of sadness in looking at how people in this country are socialized to believe that, that our country always does good, is always does well. You know, from the time kids enter elementary school and they salute to the flag and say the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, they're being inculcated with a kind of a nationalism and almost a religious belief that's not really based in reality. And so you have a situation where to truly understand what's going on, I think you need to understand the United States as the heartland of a global empire. You know, I mean, we still have our colonies actually out in the Pacific. Countries like Japan are essentially client states. Even Brzezinski, in writing his book, The Grand Chessboard, describes U.S. allies as vassal states. So you know, it's difficult to move people from kind of the illusion of what the United States is to looking at it clearly. And, of course, that illusion is then is used to cover a whole host of crimes and a class structure and tax structures and the rest here in the United States, which really limit our freedom and our ability to develop.
Yeah, U.S. peace activists, in their great obscurity and shut out from the corporate media, often point to comparisons between U.S. military spending and war making and arms dealing and the rest of the world. But it seems like you really ought to be adding in NATO members, U.S. and NATO members together. Give me a picture. I mean, it's the vast bulk of arms dealing and military spending by those nations directly, is it not?
Yeah, it moves you in the direction of about 2/3 of the world's military spending. You know, I think it's difficult. I mean, we go about our daily lives, and it's difficult to really quite imagine what, for example, the terrifying presence of a nuclear-capable U.S. aircraft carrier off your coast is. You know, what it means when the United States is essentially monopolizing the militarization of space and what follows from that. So part of our challenge, I think, is to help people to understand the systems which drive essentially the U.S. War machine and reinforce an empire, and to help them understand that, you know, with more than half of U.S. discretionary spending, our tax dollars, going for the military, you know, we end up with lead in our water, schools without books, a crumbling infrastructure while China and other countries build a much more modern 21st century infrastructure. You know, and I think one of the critical things we need to point to is that, as we all know, the seas are rising. We are a coastal civilization. Our major cities are all along the water. As the seas rise, this infrastructure, which is the foundation of our, we'll call it an American civilization, are increasingly threatened. It's going to take trillions of dollars to both protect the infrastructure that we have and to reverse climate change. Well, where's that money going to come from? It can only come from two places. One is by increasing taxes, and the other is by cutting U.S. military spending. So we need to understand that this spending, this whole war machine, independent of the question of whether we have an accidental nuclear war or a miscalculation leads us to nuclear war, the reality is that we do this military spending, we're decreasing our security on a daily basis.
Yeah, it seems to me the obvious solution, given the counterproductive nature of this militarism and all of its downsides and lack of any upside, is to stop doing it. But inevitably, you get this question, and we have about 4 minutes left in which you can try to answer it, but you get this question, well, what should we do instead? And you've mentioned the idea of common security, but how do you answer that for people?
Yeah, well, I go back to common security time and time again, you know, which cuts against the power of the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon. But just to refresh people's memory, back in the 1980s, you know, we were absolutely the brink of nuclear war. I mean, it was, people lived in daily fear of an accident or intentional nuclear war. And Olof Palme, who was then the Prime Minister of Sweden, brought together leading figures from the Soviet Union, from Europe, from the United States, to try to figure out how we move back from that brink. And the concept they came up with was common security. Common security, its foundation, as I said before, is to say, okay, what is it that I'm doing? You need to name your fears. What is it that you're doing that that makes me nervous so I build more weapons, that in turn, as I build these new weapons, make you more nervous, and we have a spiraling arms race and confrontations? And the idea is to name those fears, and then through challenging diplomacy, it doesn't happen easily, but through challenging diplomacy, to begin to negotiate resolution in ways that address the fears of your enemy or rival in ways that don't undermine your security. And this is where we need to go. I mean, the structures of power in the United States are such that we're not going to have a revolution here anytime soon. But I think this is the way that we can kind of build toward a future that provides real security for our people. I mean, years ago, it was a Methodist minister from Chile who was one of the members of one of our committees. He had been a political prisoner under Pinochet, tortured. And someone asked him, after Amnesty International had gotten him released, so when do you know if you have a military government? And his response was, well, look at your national budget. So this is the structure that we've got. These are the political challenges we have. And as a peace movement, I think we need to go beyond dealing with one crisis after the other and to be both thinking structurally of what we have here and to be putting forward alternatives like common security that will give people the confidence that there are alternatives.
Indeed, it sounds like a wonderful idea to me. We've been speaking with Joseph Gerson. He is just off to an anti-NATO summit where the NATO summit will be held in Poland. And we will have a link up at talknationradio.org to his article and to anything else that you send us, Joseph, when you get back from Poland. That would be what we have about 60 seconds left. People in Poland supportive or opposed to NATO?
Well, the conference and the demonstration is being supported and help in organizing it by a number of different Polish groups, which is not to say that there's a majority of people in Poland who are opposing NATO. I mean, they do have a historic memory of Russian occupation. They tend to forget that Poland once was the imperial power over Ukraine and an extreme right-wing government. So I have to say I'm looking forward to learning more about what's happening within Poland itself. I think what's going on there with their extreme right-wing government is part of this rise of forces that are, in many ways analogous to what happened in the 1920s and 1930s in Europe, and another source of deep concern.
Quite disturbing. We look forward to hearing what you find out. Joseph Gerson, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure, and keep up your good work.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as the country reels from police killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile and a sniper's killing of Dallas police officers, media insist there is nationwide soul-searching going on the problem of racist police brutality. Certainly there is pain and anger, but when it comes time to talk about how to change things, corporate media don't seem to have a great deal to say. We'll talk about over-policing with Alex Vitale, Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College and author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics. Also on the show, the Supreme Court deadlock on immigration policy means executive actions meant to shield some 5 million out-of-status immigrants, parents of U.S. citizens and those who came to the U.S. as children, from deportation. Media coverage tended to look at the ruling in terms of the election and the Latino vote. What else is there to say? Cristina Jimenez is co-founder and managing director of the United We Dream Network. We'll hear from her on that. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. They must have been high-fiving themselves at J.P. Morgan Chase's PR department July 12th. Chase's CEO, Jamie Dimon, was given prime space on the New York Times op-ed page to declare that his bank was doing something about wage stagnation and income inequality by giving thousands of employees a raise. Quote, over the next 3 years, we will raise the minimum pay for 18,000 employees to between $12 and $16.50 an hour for full-time, part-time, and new employees, depending on geographic and market factors, close quote. And why? A pay increase, declares Dimon, is the right thing to do. Well, how nice of the country's putative paper of record to give a corporate overlord a chance to let us know he's a mensch. Chase is the largest bank in the country. It made $24 billion last year in after-tax income. And they don't have 18,000 employees. They have 241,000. So for each of its employees, the company makes about $99,000 in profit. In that light, the prospect of a $1.85 an hour raise for 7% of them over 3 years is less than prepossessing. As for inequality, Dimon himself made $27 million last year, of which Chase's lowest-paid full-time employee makes 0.08%. After that raise, it will be 0.09%, assuming that Dimon doesn't get a raise of his own, which, well, we'll see. But here's the kicker. In New York City, where Chase is based and more than 10% of its employees work, the minimum wage will be not $12, but $15 in 2019. And many other places are following suit. So the changes that Dimon's crowing about, with an assist from the Times, will be largely legally mandated. The New York Times' editorial antipathy for Venezuela is well known, but a piece like July 11th's Neighbors Stand Up to Venezuela still stands out. As longtime FAIR analyst Mark Cook noted, the editorial relies on Paraguay's ultra-rightist government, and in particular Foreign Minister Eladio Loizaga, a diplomat left over from the decades-long dictatorship of General Alfredo Stroessner. On Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the Times quotes Loizaga, quote, you can be elected democratically but lose legitimacy over time through your actions. We can't condone any action that silences dissident voices through judicial processes that are unfair, close quote. Readers might have wanted to measure Loizaga's feelings about silencing dissidents against the fact that he has long been accused by Latin Americans, including Paraguay's own Truth and Justice Commission, of involvement in the hit squad operations of the World Anti-Communist League, an extreme right-wing organization incorporating fascist and Nazi elements and involved in murders around the globe, and in Operation Condor, the transnational death squad organized by Stroessner and the military dictatorships of Chile, Bolivia, Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay, all dictatorships imposed in Washington-sponsored coups applauded by the New York Times. That ugly history might not pose a problem to Loizaga's efforts to isolate Venezuela in Washington, D.C., or on the Times editorial page. Given that his actual neighbors include four democratically elected presidents and recent ex-presidents who were themselves victims of torture, It's less popular closer to home. And finally, quote, Amazon.com rang up its biggest sales day ever on Tuesday as shoppers hit up its Prime Day event, a day-long pageant of deals available only to members of its Prime subscription program, close quote. That was the lead on a news story, July 13th, in the Washington Post, owned, of course, by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. And the story discloses that, parenthetically. But there seems to be some confusion. While welcome, disclosure is not an inoculation. We're still allowed to look askance at a news story with lines like, quote, that the sale drew such strong spending from shoppers for a second year suggests that Amazon is making inroads establishing this as an appointment summer shopping event, close quote. When the closest thing to a critical angle is to note that some people were angry that a challenging checkout process meant, quote, they weren't able to take advantage of the deals, close quote, we've gone beyond the sort of a problem that mere disclosure can fix. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Had the U.S. gotten serious about racist police violence every time media have announced we were, we presumably would no longer wake to stories and images of black or brown men, women, and children killed by police officers who will not face punishment. Certainly there has been strong critical reporting on the issue, but for all the supposed soul-searching, media's conversation about what to do about racist law enforcement doesn't stray far from a few general ideas about reform. Activists and others say we have to go deeper and ask bigger questions about the role law enforcement plays in the country. Our next guest has been working on those questions for years. Alex Vitale is Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College and author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics. He joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome to Counterspin, Alex Vitale.
Thank you.
Let's leap right in. What are the not just limitations of, but problems with the commonly proffered responses to police brutality? Things like better training for cops, for instance.
You know, there is a role for some of these reforms, but it's a mistake to think that these are going to really solve the underlying problem. I think part of this is because the problem has been framed as one of, you know, the killing of unarmed black men. But if you look at what's been going on over the last 40 years, it's a dramatic expansion of policing across the board that really is a problem of over-policing that has contributed to mass incarceration, that has contributed to a kind of siege mentality, especially in poor communities, communities of color. And these reforms aren't really going to do anything about, for instance, the war on drugs and the devastating effect that that has had on some communities. So a totally lawful, well-executed, low-level marijuana arrest is still potentially going to destroy someone's life. And training is just not going to change that. What's needed is something that really asks, why have we so dramatically expanded the role for police, and why are we so heavily targeting poor and minority communities for this kind of intensive and invasive policing?
Well, certainly when you hear about the climate of police stations, you know, cops asking one another, are you coming home tonight, you know, or better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6, it sounds like change is in order. But how can you change the mentality that we hear about without changing the nature of the job?
Well, my friend Seth Stoughton at University of South Carolina Law School, who former police officer, he's written a lot about how the training mindset of police has driven them towards a kind of warrior mentality, mm-hmm. that they are at war with the public, and that they receive this training increasingly that shows every potential encounter with the public as a potentially deadly encounter. And I think that has contributed to several of the high-profile shootings we've seen. He says that what we need to do is model ourselves more on a European, British model that sees police as guardians, right, of the public, where the use of force or the taking of a life represents a profound failure of policing. I think the big difference, though, between the U.S. and what's going on in Europe is the intensity of kind of racialized poverty in the U.S. and the way that has clouded the politics of law and order, so that our politicians have told the police that basically they're to wage a war on crime, a war on disorder, a war on drugs, a war on terrorism. And until that political mindset shifts, it's going to be very difficult to use training or to try to change the culture of the police in some way.
Yes, and again, when we're talking about training, we are fixed on the moment of the stop. You know, a person is stopped and ends up dead. You know, something went wrong, you know, after the stop. And what I hear you getting at is we need to pull back and ask questions about why did the stop happen in the first place? You know, that narrow frame on the incident kind of obscures the deeper questions we want to get at.
Absolutely. It's not like these stops are really designed to, for instance, enhance road safety. A huge percentage of them are what we call pretextual stops, which is they use the excuse of, you know, slightly speeding or some slight vehicle defect, not to make the road safer, but to get into someone's business. Are they carrying drugs? Are they wanted for something? Is there a warrant out for their arrest? And that is an example of this kind of over-policing mentality, where the public is viewed not as someone to be helped, but as an enemy to be contained, controlled, coerced.
And when you see things like, for example, a woman going to jail for her child's, her baby's failure to thrive, you know, you have to start talking about criminalizing poverty.
Absolutely. And it has reached such epic proportions that there's a video circulating now from Southern California where a California Highway Patrol officer arrests a fireman because he's angry that the fireman has parked the fire truck in a way that's blocking traffic while performing a rescue at a traffic accident.
Wow.
And a local news crew happened to be there and watched him literally putting a uniformed firefighter in handcuffs during a rescue because of a parking violation.
That's
what we call over-policing.
Exactly. Well, another thing that I see that rankles is when media seem to sanction rhetoric about, you know, police versus black communities or police versus poor communities. There's a suggestion of a battle in which there's parity, you know, instead of one side having the power of the state, being the state. I mean, of course, police are human beings. But when we talk about the power differential, there's really there's no symmetry there.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, we have seen a dramatic expansion in the number of police over the last three decades, and also the role that they're playing, the powers that they're allowed to carry out. But ultimately, what troubles me about that conversation is that it leaves out the central role that political leaders play in framing that conflict. And in a way, by focusing on a few racist police officers or a few areas of bad training or excessive use of force, we let the elected officials off the hook. And I think that's the biggest challenge for the Black Lives Matter movement, for the larger police reform movement, is to start holding political leaders accountable for the job that they've been given police. And Chief Brown down in Dallas this week, he said quite clearly, it was on the front page of the New York Post here in New York, that they have been asked to do too much.
Right.
That when the mental health system collapses, give it to the police. When the schools don't work, give it to the police to fix. When there are homeless people in the streets, give it to the police to fix. And those are political problems.
And they are, of course, have the problem of when you are a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When, you know, police fixing homelessness is not the kind of fix that as a society we're really looking for.
Yes, absolutely. The tools they have to fix our problems are, you know, handcuffs, handguns, coercion, use of force, etc. And there are circumstances where we need someone to exercise that kind of authority, but not in a huge number of the circumstances where we've seen people killed or badly mistreated over the last couple of years.
Well, we have been here before, in a sense. There's a history, isn't there, of the idea that better law enforcement is the goal. And then things like Obama's task force on 21st century policing fit in with that kind of historical approach to these issues.
Yeah, my main problem with the Obama task force is that there's an emphasis on what has come to be called procedural justice.
Right.
Which is the idea that if we just explain to the public what we're doing and if we just follow our own rules a little better, people will accept the necessity of our enforcement actions and will hopefully come to view them as non-racist and, you know, non-excessive. But what that does is it leaves completely in place the basic orientation of massive over-policing. And so it attempts to build legitimacy for a system that is fundamentally, substantially unjust. And that is that it has these profoundly negative consequences for poor non-white folks in the U.S. through things like mass incarceration and mass criminalization of the poor. And so the Obama task force does not deal in any substantial way with that underlying justice problem. And it doesn't do anything to dial back the war on drugs, to rethink broken windows policing more substantially. And so until we start addressing those problems, what we're doing is we're tinkering with PR for the most part.
We've been speaking with Alex Vitale from Brooklyn College. You can find his recent article, "The Problem is Over-Policing," on truthout.org. Alex Vitale, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
You're most welcome.
Coming amid a number of other high-profile decisions, the Supreme Court's 4-4 deadlock blocking Barack Obama's executive actions on immigration may not have gotten the attention it deserved. The measures would have expanded eligibility for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, as well as the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans program, programs that shield people from deportation, at least temporarily. Who is affected by the ruling, and where does it fit on the bigger road to truly humane immigration policy? Cristina Jimenez is co-founder and managing director of the United We Dream Network, the country's largest immigrant youth-led organization. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Cristina Jimenez.
Thanks for having me.
United We Dream organizes and advocates for the dignity and fair treatment of immigrant youth and families, regardless of immigration status. That seems so important in a context in which, although there's been some success in getting media to stop calling human beings illegal, there still is this overwhelming focus on dividing people rhetorically based on status. But as this court ruling brings to light, people and families just don't separate into those boxes, do they?
It's not as black and white. We have millions of families across the country who live in mixed immigration status families. For example, my own family. I came at the age of 13 with my parents and my brother in 1998 from Ecuador, and we came here, you know, seeking a better life. My parents wanted to make sure that I could go to school and that they could have jobs to feed us, to raise my brother and I. And in my family alone, you have three different immigration status. Both of my parents continue to be undocumented, even though we've lived here for the past 17 years. And I have, after 16 years, a green card, a permanent resident card. And my brother is a beneficiary of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which is a temporary protection of deportation. And other families across the country have either similar situations or even have U.S. citizen children or U.S. citizen family members at the same time that they are undocumented family members, which is why the decision of the Supreme Court for millions of people was just so important. And even though the court had a split outcome and basically made no decision on the case, it meant that close to 5 million people, including families like my own, will not be able to get protection from deportation. You know, unfortunately, it's something that communities and families have been looking forward to with much hope. So it was a very, very difficult day, the day that the decision came out, and many families and millions of people were impacted by it.
Well, it sounds as though the court didn't exactly talk about the merits of the programs themselves. What was the contention? Was it really just about the executive action not being legal? I mean, it seemed to be a kind of procedural thing.
The legal debate on the court, I mean, it's, you know, we know that the lawsuit was filed by Republicans, led by Governor Abbott from the state of Texas, and then joined by other 20 Republicans from across the country who challenged the case on two bases. One, on raising the question whether the president had the constitutional presidential power to do this. And the second argument that they raise is how programs like this could raise burdens for states across the country. And we know very well that many presidents, including Republican presidents in the past, have taken similar actions, and all of the legal analysis supports the fact that this program, it was within the constitutional power of the president. It seems to us from the analysis that the question of the burden on the states was a question for debate of the court, and clearly the court was not able to end up making a decision and ended up in a 4-4 outcome, which was also impacted by the fact that there's no full Supreme Court at the moment, and a vacancy after Justice Scalia passed that has not been fulfilled because Republicans are blocking this.
Well, the media stories that I saw pretty much pivot directly to the presidential election. In response to this Supreme Court ruling, immigrants' rights groups are going to turn out the vote, is the story. I'm not saying that that's untrue, but I guess I wish there'd been more attention to the human impact of the ruling and maybe bigger questions about immigration and what kind of society we want to live in. I wonder, is there anything that you would like to see more of or less of in news media when they approach immigration reform?
Yeah, I mean, we know that, you know, there were very big decisions at the court that the court was making on several fronts, on choice, on immigration, on affirmative action. And so understandably, there was media coverage of all of those decisions, including immigration. But what was really unfortunate, and I think it really hurts the conversation around immigration if we're trying to have a debate across the country about this, is that the stories and the impact that it had on people was not really covered. And as you said, it became a political conversation about whether Latino voters or immigrant voters will turn out to vote, and what will be the impact on the election. And that it is one very valid point, which is true. There is a very important connection between how the community feels about the impact of the decision and how that will impact in November and how they turn out to vote. But in addition to that, there are the stories and the families like my own that were impacted by this that was not necessarily an angle that the media focused on. And so in thinking about why I would have wanted to see more in the conversation would have been coverage of immigrant families and immigrant communities that would have been directly impacted by this, in addition to really talking about what matters in terms of what's at stake in the elections, right? So for Democrats and Republicans, what's at stake is the votes, and they are both in the battle to keep power or to gain power. But for communities like the ones that United We Dream works with, which will work largely with Latino and immigrant communities in over 25 states, what is at stake is really an existential threat for us, because candidates like Donald Trump have committed publicly multiple times to basically wipe out the country from people like myself and my parents and 11 million people who are here, who are immigrants. And this is a huge deal for Latino voters, for Asian American voters, and for largely immigrant communities across the country. And that has not necessarily been an angle that the media has focused on, but rather, you know, has really paid attention a lot to what this means in terms of votes, when in reality what we're talking about is a wave of hate and public promises of blocking migration from Muslim countries and wiping the country out of people like myself and millions of families.
We've been speaking with Christina Jimenez of the United We Dream Network. Christina, how can folks find your work online and possibly get involved?
We are online and also are very active in social media platforms. So if you go to UnitedWeDream.org, that is our website. You can find us there. And you can find us on Facebook on United We Dream, as well as our Twitter account, which is at United We Dream. And those are ways in which that the community and your listeners can know about our work and can engage in the different states where we are active.
All right, then. Thank you very much, Christina Jimenez from United We Dream, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org. And that's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Erica Bassett. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
Are humans changing the planet so much that we've entered a new geological age? They call it the Anthropocene, and we don't know if that's good. Our first guest from Berlin, Christian Schwagerl, literally wrote the book on it. Then we'll hear a different view from two ecofeminists, American Green Party founder Charlene Spretnak and author Susan Griffin. First to Berlin.
Yes, the bustling world of a thousand moods reflects the dreams of its ambitious inhabitants, dreams already realized of man's triumph over nature.
Radio EcoShock.
I received an invitation to read a book newly coming out for English readers. The title is The Anthropocene, The Human Era, and How It Shapes Our Planet. Little did I know how deep and sometimes disturbing this adventure into ideas would become. The author is Christian Schwagerl. He's been one of the best environmental journalists in Berlin for 25 years. Christian holds a Master of Science degree himself. When the first German version of this book was published as Mensch und Zeit, or The Age of Humans, the head of the United Nations Environment Program, Achim Steiner, spoke at the book launch. From Berlin, Christian Schwagerl, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on the program.
Well, of course, we must start with the definition of what the word Anthropocene means. That can take a couple of chapters, I know, but would you give us an introduction to its meaning?
The Anthropocene is a geological concept. It reflects how much we humans affect the planet, how much we are changing it. And I'm not just talking about climate. I'm talking about the way humans change the surface of the Earth, change the soils, change the course water runs, change the evolution of animals and plants, changes the biodiversity. So Anthropocene basically means that we humans have become the dominant force of change on Earth, and that our actions actually are not just, we're not just kind of scratching the surface of the Earth. We are changing the Earth system deeply. We are changing it fast. And we are changing it for a long time. So what we do now will be visible in the geological record for a long time. And that's why a Nobel laureate, Paul Crutzen, came up with this word to say, look, it's the age of humans in a sense that we are changing the geology, the biology, the chemistry of Earth for a long future. And in the future, it will be able to look back and see what we have done.
Yes, we can't really understand the Anthropocene or the movement developing around it without knowing a little bit about this famous scientist, Paul Crutzen. You've been involved with him over the years. How would you introduce Paul to our audience?
Yeah, Paul is a scientist who's not just interested in science. He's a great scientist. He started the research on the CFCs, those substances that are dangerous for the ozone layer. And he saw already in the early 70s that there are substances that are dangerous for the layer that protects the Earth from ultraviolet radiation. And he kind of triggered the research that led to the discovery of the ozone hole and to the political efforts to then ban the dangerous substances. And so Paul actually was involved also in the political campaign in order to ban these dangerous substances. So he's a man with a sort of broad horizon, and this ozone experience kind of made him think, you know, what else are we doing and what else might happen? So he kept being concerned, and he kept making these lists of things humans do with Earth and how we are changing basically the metabolism of Earth, the workings of the Earth system. And that's why in the year 2000, it was more or less, as he describes it, a spontaneous idea in a meeting in Mexico, a scientific meeting. People were talking of the Holocene, and that's, you know, in the school books you learn we are living in the Holocene. That's the geological epoch that has started roughly 11,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age. And that's what pupils learn today at school. You know, we live in the Holocene. And these scientists were talking about the Holocene. And in this meeting in the year 2000, Paul Crutzen stood up and said, you know, no, look, no, we are not living in the Holocene anymore. We live in the Anthropocene, the age of humans or the epoch of humans. And as he describes it, people were stunned because this word really is very strong. The new age of humans, that's what it, that's the literal meaning of it is. And so, you know, he's now very excited. He's already almost 81 years old, and he's very excited now that this idea is kind of going viral at the moment.
Our listeners are environmentally aware people, Christian, and some are already thinking that naming an age after ourselves is just another example of our focus on everything human or anthropocentrism. How do you answer that?
Yeah, I think that's a very important concern. And I think it's important to actually avoid this sort of interpretation. And Paul Crutzen is kind of terrified by the idea that people might say, oh, great, it's the age of humans. Now we can do everything. You know, it's our age. It's the age of kind of engineering everything and of kind of human dominion over Earth. And that's not his way of thinking. You could actually argue that there's this danger that this word kind of makes us become even more anthropocentric. But my experience is different, because when you start realizing how much we do, and that's what the Anthropocene word captures, you know, how much happens on so many levels. And when you compare it with how much of it we understand, think about climate change or soil erosion or biodiversity loss, and if you compare it with how many of these changes have positive outcomes for ourselves, then you start realizing that it would be the most horrible idea to make the Anthropocene something anthropocentric, although the two words sound so similar. And my approach is that it's actually the total opposite, that through realizing how much we change, how much we interwoven we are with the Earth system, we come to realize that this is an age where we kind of find out how much we are part of nature. So this Anthropocene idea in a way makes us part of nature, something we have avoided in Western civilization. We've always tried to kind of put us above nature or outside nature and look at our economy. It extracts from nature, but it doesn't give any value to nature itself, to like untouched nature, to wilderness, to biodiversity, all zero value given to it. And so it's kind of blind to nature, and it always, our system, Western thinking, always tries to put us above nature. And the Anthropocene idea kind of roots us back into Earth geology and back into nature. And if you come out anthropocentric out of this process, I think something has gone terribly wrong. And my feeling is that the Anthropocene idea will actually make us less anthropocentric.
Good. Well, let's talk about the argument for naming a new age. You say humans have affected geology, chemistry, and biology. Why don't we just start with geology? Surely we can't have that much effect on rivers and rocks and the structure of the Earth?
Yeah, once you start looking into this, and I'm a biologist, so I was mainly concerned also in my writing with like things like biodiversity. But when you start looking at the actual geology of Earth, you start discovering that humans have already created something like 5 million mines on the planet, you know, spots where we have started to dig tunnels or create large open pits. Mountaintop mining is a very strong geological intervention. Think about cities, for example. I mean, you don't always have to think about the very negative things. Cities themselves are a geological thing. They are made of stone that has been brought from very different parts of the world in many cases, and glass and other synthetic materials. So they will form in the future when a geologist, say in a million years, a hypothetical geologist will look back, he will find a very funny layer of things of mixed stone that was a city. Other examples are, I mean, if you look at aluminium, like the isolated aluminium we use in the aluminium foils, there's so much aluminium extracted from the earth now and purified that you could cover the whole United States into aluminium foil. Or think about plastic. Plastic can actually become something like a stone. It kind of gets fossilized. And there's now enough plastic in the oceans and so on that you could wrap the whole earth in cling film, which is also amazing. Think about the levels of like carbon dioxide that will remain in stones or in the ice if there is anything left on a warming planet in the future. That is also a sort of geological thing. Think about the radionuclides from the atomic tests and the actual bombs that were dropped. So these are artificial elements that will stay in the geological records for a very long time. Think about all the canals we have made changing the course of water. And all of these things, if you the list is really long. And when you add up the list, you come to a point where really we are changing geology to such an extent that future geologists will see our imprint. We are creating a geological record that will have a human imprint on it.
You had a couple of really fun ideas there. I think if we wrap the world in plastic wrap, maybe it would keep longer. And it certainly would be fun to see America covered in tinfoil, even if only for a day. Well, has any official scientific body agreed to the Anthropocene, or will they do so soon?
Yeah, well, I think it's really important and good you're mentioning this. This comes from science. It's on the one side, it stays a scientific hypothesis. So there is a formal institution that kind of the people that are, you could call them the guardians of Earth time. So Earth is, what, 4.6 billion years old, and these people have the job to divide this history up into like chapters and subchapters and paragraphs and sentences. So you could kind of make it accessible for our understanding. So that's where you have the Cretaceous or the Devonian or the Jurassic. So these large kind of chapters of Earth history. And there's an international scientific body called the International Commission on Stratigraphy, who is kind of in charge of keeping Earth time and dividing it up. And this group has now set up a working group. It's called the Anthropocene Working Group, to actually look into the evidence. So to see whether what is captured by the word Anthropocene has a scientific reality. And that is a very strict process. There are strict scientific geological criteria that have to be met. For example, you need a global signal that is kind of very different from what happened before. For example, when the dinosaurs died out, suddenly there were no dinosaur bones anymore in the geological record. So you can basically draw a very good line there and say, okay, end of the dinosaur chapter, no bones anymore. Now, for example, today you could say we now have billions of cattle that are slaughtered every year for our needs, and bones remain, and a lot of them are buried, or the chicken bones that get thrown away and end up in landfills. So in a future geological record, so 56 million years ago, you had suddenly the dinosaur bones went missing. But in the Anthropocene, the cattle and chicken bones, they come into the geological record. So these guys, they now make a kind of a long list again, or an analysis, whether geological criteria are met. And in 2016, so in 2 years' time, they want to come up with a first official vote. And the process is longer, but this will be a very important milestone. And the Anthropocene itself now inspires a lot of scientists to kind of reassess their work and do more about researching human-caused changes. It's one thing, for example, that the biological research stations, they're all kind of concentrated in the remaining wilderness areas, which is great. I mean, they have to be there. But 75% of Earth's surface is now modified by humans, and there are far too few biological research stations that kind of really explore the human-made changes. So now there's kind of this reassessment that we really have to look into this new nature, which we create on 75% of the planet's surface, which is modified, the agricultural deserts, for example, the monocultures and things like that.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. Christian Schwagerl, the further I travel into your book, The Anthropocene, The Human Era, and How It Shapes Our Planet, I become a little uneasy, and it starts with your arguments for optimism. You grew up being a nuclear target in Bavaria, and yet now you say no apocalypse. Why not?
Right. Well, I think that it's really important to have this sense of urgency. I mean, with climate change and biodiversity loss and many other problems, plastic pollution in the oceans, we see a lot of things are happening fast, and we really need to do something now. You know, not something. We need to do a lot. We need to go into systemic changes, I think, in the way our economies are run, our politics sets priorities, and other things. So I don't want to play down anything. The problem is, and I have been, you know, socialized in a very kind of environmentally conscious area in Bavaria, and in my job as a journalist, I have a lot to do with environmentalists, and I admire a lot of them for what they do. But often I come into this sort of doom way of thinking, oh my God, we are lost, you know, and the earth is already kind of beyond hope, and the apocalypse is nigh, the end is nigh. And this kind of doomsday thinking, I think, stops us from developing really kind of creative ideas for how the future might look like, and also positive stories of how we want the world to look like in the future. And we leave these positive stories to the, you know, techno commercial guys who are selling, want us to shop us to death. And we're not kind of creating a counter narrative in a sense, because we say, well, you know, it's the apocalypse. Climate change will kill us all, and the planet is doomed already. And I think in the environmental movement in particular, there's a great need for spreading hope and spreading kind of positive ideas of what people with an environmental consciousness and conscience want the world to be. And this apocalypse idea stops us from it. I mean, there's this famous saying by the Protestant reformer Martin Luther, that if he knew the apocalypse was nigh and the world would end tomorrow, he would still plant an apple tree, right? One says that a lot here in Germany. I think it's wrong. I mean, if I knew the world would end tomorrow, I would not plant an apple tree. I would try and eat apple pie. So I think by saying the apocalypse is nigh, we are encouraging people actually to become even more short-term, to just have a big party and consume as much as they like, because, you know, it doesn't matter anyway. So we need to kind of go beyond that and say the problems are urgent, but we will have to live with them for a very long time. And our kids and grandchildren and all the other living beings we share the planet with, they will have to stick with what we are leaving them behind for a very long time, for the next, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, perhaps in some instances. Think about nuclear waste. So I think we, by creating this idea of a long future, we are actually increasing a sense of urgency and responsibility. And the apocalypse-type thinking makes people kind of hopeless, perhaps passive, or even worse, kind of, you know, think, you know, now let's have this final party. And, you know, I don't think that's good.
Well, I'm going to ask you to explain your positive vision at the end of this interview, because I think that's a good way to wrap up. But first, I do have a couple of doubts about a couple of things you've written. For example, you say, even if climate change turns out to be worse than scientists at the IPCC fear, it will not lead to the end of the world or the collapse of civilization. This won't even come to pass if climate change, food crises, and cyber wars all occur simultaneously. Really, I mean, if the climate warms by 6 degrees or more in less than 200 years, as some scientists have suggested, you think civilization will still stand?
Yeah, well, it will be a very different civilization, and I'm not sure I would want to live in it or with it. It might be kind of, you know, military dictatorship that is really horrible, and it just kind of digging itself into the geology, perhaps, you know, people moving into the civilization, moving into caves. We have a very famous author here in Germany, Alfred Döblin, who kind of wrote a science fiction in the 1920s exactly about that, that, you know, a kind of techno-military dictatorship will move to the caves with, you know, high-tech civilization. So what I'm trying to say with this in the book is that we humans are very resilient. I mean, we're living from the polar areas to the tropics. We're living from the kind of along the seashores to the highest mountains. We are a very resilient species. And I'm not saying that our civilization, the way we live now, will persist. I'm just saying that a human civilization, most probably. I mean, I'm not a prophet. I can't really foretell the future. It's just what I'm trying to say is that there will not be a final curtain. You know, and often in these kind of climate change diagrams, you see that in 2050 or now 2100, and then there is this end. And what I'm trying to say is, no, there is no end. You know, it will continue. If we change the climate by like 6 degrees, you know, we will have to live with it. That's basically my main point. And I'm not saying it will not hugely change our civilization. I just think that humans will still be around for a very long time, and they will have to live with what we do now.
And then you have a chapter called Directing Evolution, and I ask myself, who is going to direct evolution? Will it be a cabal of multi-billionaires? I mean, democracy's almost dead here in North America. Who would direct it? Monsanto, or?
Yeah, well, that's happening, and I don't like it. And I think that's really important to see that part of this Anthropocene that's happening is that humans gain the knowledge and also the power to really change organisms on a genetic level. We've been breeding animals for 10,000 years and changing plants for a long time, but now the methods to do that become more powerful. And that's why I think it's really important to have this democratic revolution to kind of reclaim evolution in a way so that not big corporations take it away from us, patent it, and then sell it back to us. I think that there needs to be, and I share your concerns about the crisis of democracy. But when we now enter a phase where we really design new organisms, perhaps we don't want to do this. This would be also a democratic decision. But we are changing organisms on so many levels globally that I think there needs to be a democratic approach to that as opposed to a very kind of narrow corporate process that makes just a few people rich and making the earth poorer. We need to see that it's not just about kind of clinging to old type nature. It's about how to design the process that creates new beings.
Well, as you write in your book, there has been a small debate from Andy Revkin in the New York Times to Elizabeth Colbert about whether that can be a good Anthropocene. You do wrap up your book with a personal vision of how things might not turn out so badly as many people think. Please take a minute or two to take us on a tour of how we might survive ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because if the Anthropocene as an idea would just be the sum of all environmental problems, I think then we would have to fight it. You know, then we'd have to say, you know, we must fight to stay in the Holocene. But I think part of the Anthropocene is to become aware of this global responsibility and to act. And so I think it's very inspirational to act and to change things. So, for example, I think that our lifestyles are very important. The way we connect with nature are very important. So I'm not a person who thinks that there are technological solutions, but I think technology plays a good role. And part of my scenario is that we really learn to imitate nature in a positive way, to create like cars that are biodegradable and electronic gadgets that are biodegradable. So to kind of make the technosphere part of the biosphere in a positive sense. So I have examples of that in my book of, this is very kind of fictional, of course, but of like bionic whales that are set free in the ocean to feed on the plastic in the ocean and to digest it, basically. Another example I'm giving, and that is of a social movement, is that I think China will be the hotbed of the next environmental movement. You have pressing environmental problems there, the smogs and everything. And you have a longing for participation. And I think I'm hopeful that Asia will see the rise of a new environmental movement. A third area I would like to mention is the question how our economy works. And I know this is problematic, but I think as long as money is so important, I think we need to start attribute some monetary value to what is important. And that is like something like wilderness or biodiversity. And you could say this is the final commodification of everything, and I'm scared of that as well. But as long as the money system is so important, I think, and that's part of my scenario, that through that, societies need to learn to reappreciate the value that is offered to us by living systems, by living wilderness areas, or functioning harmonic biocultural landscapes that are rich in biodiversity. So I think we need to broaden the horizon of our economic system to the what's really valuable, and nature is a big part of that. So my scenario kind of describes a process of realizing all of this and ending up in an Anthropocene that deserves the word good.
The book, The Anthropocene, The Human Era and How It Shapes Our Planet, is available now from Synergetic Press at a very reasonable price of just $10 for the paperback. The electronic version is coming soon. You can find links to all this, including a YouTube presentation by Christian Schwagerl, in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Christian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
But we, who are all that are left of the old engineers and mechanics, have pledged ourselves to salvage the world. We have the airways, all that's left of them. We have the seas, and we have ideas in common. The brotherhood of efficiency, the freemasonry of science. We're the last trustees of civilization when everything else has failed.
I've been waiting for this.
Are we ready for tech nature and human creation of new life forms? Find more of my impressions on this book and links to the works discussed in this interview in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. It seems appropriate that we are now going to two speakers from the recent conference, Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. It was held in New York City on October 25th and 26th, 2014. This teach-in was presented by the International Forum on Globalization and the New York Open Center. It was recorded by Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. I'm reversing the order of our speakers, starting with Charlene Spretnak on The Resurgence of the Real.
And our final panelist today will be Charlene Spretnak. She is the co-founder of the U.S. Green Party and the author of Green Politics, The Resurgence of the Real, Relational Reality, and many eco-social essays. She was named by the British government as one of the 100 eco-heroes of all time. And her newest book, The Spiritual Dynamic in Modern Art, was just published this week. Charlene will be speaking today on the importance of understanding organic, dynamic interrelatedness in assessing technology. Welcome, Charlene.
I'm going to come at this subject from a somewhat different direction, building on these astute critiques my fellow panelists have given about essentially a lot of examples they stated from what is the mechanistic worldview. And that, of course, has shaped our systems of knowledge. It shaped the way we were all socialized and the way we relate to technology. So the mechanistic worldview holds that every person and every entity is essentially separate and discrete. And entities, whether they're people or marsupials or poplar trees, they can be in some kind of relationship or not. But that certainly doesn't affect their internal constitution and the way they function physically. So that's the mechanistic perspective. But there's also a relational perspective, which acknowledges that every entity exists in a field of dynamic interrelationships. And they definitely do affect how your internal organ systems work and how you function in the world. And the interrelationships are dynamic, meaning they're always in flux. They respond to minute changes. They're creative, unpredictable, and full of possibilities. Now, even in the 19th century, there were some people who saw there are some real problems with the assumptions and premises of the mechanistic worldview. And really, there's been this attempted correction of it going on, at least since 1905 with Einstein's two papers, which established a relational perspective on matter and energy. But it's turned out that the mechanistic worldview has been very difficult to dislodge. And you may remember that there were a number of best-selling books in the last quarter of the 20th century, And these were all about the implications of relational discoveries in quantum physics, and then chaos theory, and then complexity studies. And these books asserted that soon this relational thinking from these discoveries would ripple out and transform all our institutions. Right. We can look around and see that our institutions were not transformed. And I think that's probably because the nature of those discoveries was too abstract for most people to pay a lot of attention to. So there was one partial success story, of course, from that period, which started out being called alternative medicine and then complementary medicine, integral medicine, which was eventually given a small, grudgingly given a small and very incongruous place in the mainstream medical system. But the millennial turning came and went, and I was still waiting to see the big correction, the grand correction to the mechanistic worldview. And I have to admit, I really got to a point where I thought, I may not see this. It may not happen in my lifetime. Okay. But then, around 2004, I opened the newspaper one morning, and I saw a small article, and it was on a discovery about the human body. And the researchers said they were very surprised by the findings. So I read that article, and I was very surprised by the findings. And then a few weeks later, I saw a similar one, and then I saw more in the months and years that followed. So I started saving all these because I saw that what these new discoveries had in common was that they were challenging the prevailing view of the human organism as essentially a biomachine, a very complicated biomachine. And these discoveries were actually revealing, they were surprising because they were revealing the extent to which the human organism actually is structured by and functions through dynamic interrelationships. So I had bulging files of this eventually, and I drew them all together and presented them in this book, Relational Reality, a couple of years ago. But they kept on coming, so I have another bulging file, and you'll see them now because you'll be able to recognize, oh, I see, that's another one that is showing these relational results that go against the mechanistic assumptions. So I'm going to give you just a few examples. One of them was they did a study a few years ago of 906 elderly adults, and they found that the ones that had few friendships or other social interactions had a rapid decline in motor function, standing, gripping, balancing. And then there was a study 2 years ago, 2012. This is about children, the development of children. And they found that children who between ages 5 and 10 experience violence, either physically being brought on them, or even witnessing violence, those children then had an erosion in the telomeres, which is part of the DNA structures in their cells, a shortening of the telomeres, which is what happens in the aging process. And the study found that the more types of violence the child witnessed, the faster the telomeres eroded, shortening their lifespan. So direct and but even observed violence affects the human body at the cellular level. And then also our body-mind is in dynamic relationship not only with other people but with the rest of the natural world. So one study a few years ago of people who live in the projects in Chicago in this one housing project, it found that the residents who were at the far end of the project next to trees and green open space, they not only had less anxiety and depression, but they had many fewer incidents of physical diseases like diabetes, asthma, intestinal problems, and back pains. So there are so many, actually, recent discoveries about the relationship between humans and nature that you may have noticed that hospitals have now redesigned their decor to have nature motifs. Which costs a lot of money. So that's how established it is, only in the last 12 years with all this research. And if you've been in a hospital recently, you may have noticed the drapery often has a leaf motif. And in the patient's room, they've put a big photograph of a mountain scene. And in the corridors, they have these little water fountains, you know, with water running over stones. And sometimes in the MRI room, the last thing people see when they're being rolled in is the blue sky with white, fluffy clouds. So the reason they're doing that is because it's been very firmly established that connecting with nature, even through a photograph, helps our healing process. And I call this new field of knowledge that's emerging relational physiology. And it's different, I feel, because these discoveries, unlike the earlier ones, are so concrete and so accessible, and it's moving very quickly into mainstream areas. But what I'd like to focus on in the time remaining is just one of our organs, the brain, because it's always been held in the mechanistic view of the human body-mind, of course, that we arrive in this world with a certain capacity of mental functioning. You might be born smart or born dumb or something in between, but it's understood that you arrive with a certain kind of brain, and that's it. Now, however, that assumption is being strongly challenged by several studies that found there are numerous relational factors from infancy on through childhood that affect the development of an adult's level of intelligence. So here are five examples of what I call the relational physiology of intelligence. The first one's breastfeeding. So researchers have realized for a long time that breastfeeding is good for the physical reason that there are neurosugars in the breast milk that helps brain development. But now studies have also determined that the hours of interaction between the mother and the baby are exchanging all kinds of information through touch and language and other body language that stimulates brain development. And one study said that it controlled for lots of socioeconomic factors, but it said a baby who is breastfed for 1 year without other food being added yet gets a 6-point bounce on an IQ test, even though we know there are problems with IQ tests, but a standardized intelligence test. 6 points is what they determined. Number two, certain brain disorders. There's the example of autism. This is a new study that was just published last month by the University of California at Davis. You cannot make a definite diagnosis of autism before age 2, but as young as 6 months, certain symptoms start to show up, like rapid eye movement or fixation, unusual fixation on an object, or abnormal repetitive movements and not wanting to make eye contact. So this study identified a number of infants who were symptomatic between ages 6 months and 1 year, and it divided them into four groups. One of the groups got this therapy called Early Start, and they trained the mothers and sometimes both parents, how to do certain motions, certain sounds, often down on the carpet with the child, certain movements every day. And by the time these babies were 3 years old, the group that had had the early start intervention had no symptoms of autism, no language delays, and no other developmental delays. So this relational interaction had affected the brain and probably the synaptic pathways. And then number three, family dynamics. Well, about 25 years ago, it was noticed by some researchers that, again, drawing on the IQ test, the firstborn child, eldest child in a family, tends to generally, score 2 or 3 points higher on the IQ test than his or her siblings. So, of course, they figured it must be something going on with the brain of the firstborn. But in 2007, a study was done in Norway of 2,041 military records of 18- and 19-year-old boys who have to go into the service. And the researchers then, looking at these records, had not only the IQ score of the test the military had given, but it also had the family history of each boy. And what they found was, if the firstborn child had died early in childhood, or even if the first two children had died early and the thirdborn had been raised as the eldest, that child then scored the extra 2 or 3 points on the IQ test at age 19 that's generally seen of the firstborns. So family dynamics were affecting the development expression of intelligence. And they didn't speculate why, but, you know, parents tend to give the eldest child more responsibility, watch the kids, we're going out, and the eldest tends to identify more with the adult world and test-taking. It might have something to do with that, but they didn't say. And then, number four, violation and damage to the developmental process. It's been found in many studies, cross-culturally, that whipping, spanking, beating a child lowers IQ. And the more spanking, the more it lowers the IQ. And culturally, if it's accepted and expected that all children will be whipped or spanked, you can see culturally, collectively, the scores are suppressed, even factoring in for socioeconomic factors. So the violence is apparently an anti-relational trauma to the whole system. And then last, number five, language and the relational formation of our intelligence. A researcher named Betty Hart found in the mid-1990s that children who were exposed to a lot of language in conversation before age three did much better in reading and math and intelligence tests in school than children who had heard many fewer words during that period. So there's been a lot of studies recently working off of that and developing it. And one thing they found is that if the child was hearing a lot of words in conversation, not from the mother or primary caregiver, but rather from the television set, it not only didn't have the same effect, it had a detrimental effect on their intelligence abilities later. Before I go on, let me just say the baby Einstein device, do you remember that? Why that went by the by? When those children got to first and second grade, they had lower ability than the ones. So what I started to say before I thought of that, you cannot substitute the organic with the technological and expect that it's not going to be damaging. And that fact is apparently very widely recognized among high-tech parents in Silicon Valley. You may see in some of these articles in the paper where they go to these big names and say, wow, your house must be like an electronic cottage, the journalist will say. And the guy says, no, we don't let our kids go on that. And they said, really, you don't? No, they either have no televisions and computers in the house or screen time, or at a certain age they'll let them have 1 or 2 hours a week. Or they send them even to Waldorf schools, no TV in the house. So one of the journalists asked these high-tech couples why they keep their children away from screen time, and they replied, quote, because we've seen what it does to people who were raised that way, unquote. Meanwhile, of course, their own company's marketing departments are just going full bore to convince parents all across the country that it'll benefit their child hugely to have them glued to a screen from infancy on, when, in fact, this electronic immersion is tremendously damaging to their development. So, in summary, even though it's 2014, we are just now beginning to grasp in mainstream venues that we human organisms are far, far more dynamically interrelated than modern thinking ever assumed. And of course, this deeply relational nature of reality was and is self-evident to indigenous cultures, but we hypermodern folks are pretty much at a kindergarten level of figuring out our own physical nature and how we work. It's not the way we were schooled. So one way for us to assess the effects of technology in our lives is to pay attention to whether time spent on an electronic device is significantly reducing the time and availability we need for organic relationships. But we face two difficulties in making assessments like that. First, because modern people are socialized in the mechanistic worldview, every new device seems really swell, and we're slow to see the detrimental effects. And second, because we do not yet recognize all that needs to be protected in this life, it's hard for us to make those assessments. But just keep in mind that we exist in, each of us, every moment, we're embedded in these gazillions of organic dynamic relationships. It's exhilarating. Thank you.
You just heard Charlene Spretnak, a founder of the U.S. Green Party, author and ecofeminist. Our next speaker from the forum Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth is the famous ecofeminist Susan Griffin. Her topic is Women in Nature, Speed, Consciousness, and Quantification.
Next, I'd like to welcome Susan Griffin. Susan is a poet, essayist, playwright, and screenwriter. She's the author of over 20 books, including Women in Nature, which inspired the eco-feminist movement. Her book on nuclear weapons, A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, was a New York Times notable book and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Susan was named by Utney Reader as one of 100 visionaries for the new millennium. She's currently writing a book called Sustainability and the Soul, and her remarks today will reflect that work. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
I contemplate a tree. I can assign it to a species and observe it as an instance. I can dissolve it into a number, but it can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into a relation, and the tree ceases to be an it. Those are the words that Martin Buber wrote in 1923 in his classic I, Thou. Along with Eileen and Tom and Lisa, you know, I think what we're stating here today is that what we have in our society today is an I-it, not an I-thou relationship with nature. And that I-it, by the way, relationship extends to various groups within our culture, the way we view indigenous peoples, the way we view women, the way we view people of color, is also tends to be more objectifying and closer to an it than a thou. But at the same time, you know, more science is discovering intelligence in the universe and in nature every day. I learn about something, it seems that I learn about something new, some way that plants have intelligence, extraordinary. The abstract thinking of slime mold, have you heard about that? It's quite amazing. They can solve these incredible labyrinthine problems. But we still are hanging on to this experiential attitude. We may have a cognitive recognition of intelligence and or soul or an inner life in nature, but we hang on to this idea of the universe as essentially dead. And that creates some problems for us. It leads to global warming, it leads to economic inequities, but there's also another problem which is essentially psychological. And this psychological problem reinforces the economic and social attitudes that we have that are exploiting the earth. And that is that we can't have a meaningful relationship anymore with many of us with nature. And that's because it's very difficult to maintain or to even initiate a stimulating relationship with a corpse. So we've got some solutions, though. A solution like the steam train, which really inaugurated in many ways the Industrial Revolution. The steam train had another purpose. And that was, it functioned as a kind of mechanical Viagra, for both sexes, of course. It brought excitement back into life. Now, of course, the steam train promised a kind of utopia, as every new invention does. Mark Secund, for instance, who was the inventor of the wide cable suspension bridge, you know, wrote that the enjoyment, the commodities of life, which had been reserved for only men of fortune, will be shared by all classes. Now, in fact, we know that that's not at all what happened with the Industrial Revolution, nor with the steam train, that the Industrial Revolution led to terrible economic inequality as people took the train into the cities. There was a surplus of labor, and in addition to that, children were exploited in labor. But clearly, at the same time, the steam trade had something really thrilling to offer, and Sequin talks about that. Long ribbons of iron along which rush, rapid as thought, those fordable machines which seem to eat up space with a spontaneous impatience and which seem almost alive in their breathing and their movement. So you can see the erotic nature of this great love of steam trains. So here's the incredible thing. The formidable erotic powers of the steam train seem to restore the life force that our worldview had stolen from nature, even while it was instrumental in destroying nature. Does anybody know what this is here? Bison skulls. So what would happen is on the steam trains that went west, one of the attractions of that rail trip to the west was that the train would stop in certain places where buffalo herds roamed, and the men on the train could get off and they could shoot. And so the buffalo almost became extinct. In the early part of the 19th century, speed itself became the object of adulation. It was worshipped by many, including especially the Italian writer and founder of a movement called Futurism, F.T. Marinetti. And I'm going to read you a few words from an essay he wrote called The New Religion, Morality of Speed. The futurist morality will protect man against the inevitable decay produced by slowness, memory, analysis, rest, and habit. Human energy, multiplied by 100-fold by velocity, will dominate space and time. Velocity has given human life one of the attributes of divinity, the straight line. Velocity is naturally pure, slowness is naturally unclean. After destroying traditional good and evil, we are creating a new good, speed, and a new evil, slowness. We intend to glorify war. This is from another piece that he wrote called The Futurist Manifesto. He wrote, we intend to glorify war, the only hygiene of the world, militarism, patriotism, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and contempt for women. You see the way that all of these things fit together? Marinetti became... He was the head of what was the Futurist political party, which merged in Italy with the Fascist party. And he became a staunch supporter of Mussolini, leading to this. Doesn't that look like those bison skulls? You know, that's Florence after a bombardment in World War II. So seeing nature as dead, then we create our own deaths. But instead of questioning our worldview at any point, we simply accelerate our efforts to awaken ourselves, to re-stimulate ourselves. So we've come up with a new kind of Viagra, and that is electronic Viagra. So I thought of this when I saw an ad for some sort of, I don't know what it was, for some sort of software, something to do with computers. It was something that was a faster connection. It probably had to do with the internet, and it was faster because speed is the most important element that is advertised for anything in the world of computers right now. So it shows a guy, and he's getting this really fast connection, and he declares, I never felt more alive. But actually, what a computer is it's a simulacrum of life, and it's dead. It's a dead simulacrum of life, what you're seeing on the screen. So once again, the claim was made with computers is that it's going to equalize everything. It's going to put us all on an equal footing, especially politically. We're going to be able to get the word out, and to some extent we can do that. But what the computer, with its speed, is best at is accumulating big data. And big data is very good for accumulating big wealth. So that's its main function in the business world. I want to quote to you from Emma Uprichard, from the University of Warwick. She's a professor of sociology. And this is what she has to say about big data. It's being presented as the future problem solver for all things, from breast cancer to low-cost governance, from better security to predictive systems, from smart cities and better traffic and water systems to an end to urban squalor. It promises cleaner, more sustainable, renewable energy, better banking, better governance, better education for all, more efficient, faster, more cost-effective everything. If we thought utopian authors were full of hope for better futures, the public discourse of big data is akin to a future fairy godmother with a magic wand granting wishes to help solve some of the world's most wicked problems. Of course, you know, I'm not arguing here against the collection of data at all. I love the data about the 99%, for instance, versus the 1%. There's some very important data that is also being, young people are being studied, and it's found, for instance, that in the United States, young people tend to be 75 times more violent than young people in other nations. So this kind of data is useful. But numbers are stripped of the earth. They're stripped of place. I mean, the numbers, the big data, the computers have realized Marinetti's dream. They're stripped of place, time. They're stripped of also of stories, breakfast, lunch, dinner, smiles, tears, empathy, emotional intelligence, not to speak of, in fact, the real erotic mysteries that come to us from sunrise, sunset, the night sky, a flight of birds, migrating south for the summer, or the eyes of somebody we love. Numbers don't have any of that. That's their virtue. They're supposedly objective, and therefore they're placed, by the way, above human responses and above us. For instance, you know, I hate public polls, and I hate polls of all kinds and questionnaires. For instance, if I'm asked, you know, have you ever been arrested? I would have to say yes, I was arrested. And then that would place me closer on a scale to a psychopath because I've been arrested. That's part of the data that makes you a psychopath. However, it doesn't ask me what I was arrested for or why I was arrested. I was arrested once protesting apartheid, once protesting the build-up to the war in Iraq, and another time because I refused to move when I was witnessing an incident, incidents of police brutality. There's this other idea that somehow the data is never wrong, but it's often wrong because the data comes from ultimately a subjective viewpoint. This idea that an objective viewpoint is possible is not even possible in science, much less in social science. What we're doing is we're completing a sort of ultimate feedback cycle. Another way to think about it is that it's a very elaborate Ponzi scheme. You know, we're promised that we're going to get rich, but actually it's impoverishing us all. Not only is it impoverishing the environment, but we're starting to impoverish ourselves. When we impoverish our idea of the body and the way we heal and approach the body, that's a very serious lessening of ourselves, of our being. But what we're also impoverishing right now is consciousness. Ironically, we start with an epistemology saying there's an I and an it, and the I is supposed to be ensouled and have intelligence and empathy, and the it is an object. Now we're making consciousness itself into an it.
At this point, to meet our time limitations, I removed a few minutes of Susan Griffin's comments on education in the United States. We'll go to her conclusion, which follows from her beginning remarks.
I'm going to end with a quote because there are many cultures that still do carry an understanding of nature as thou and live by that. And I'm going to quote you from a poem by the Senegalese poet. I'm going to end with these words. From the Senegalese poet Tiro Seydou Sall. Having become choreographers, the stars orchestrate in their white robes, tapestries of dreams, pain and joy, pulsations of love in the heart of life.
That was ecofeminist Susan Griffin. These presentations come from the New York City teach-in at the end of October called Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. Our recordings are courtesy of Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Now, we don't know if tomorrow is scheduled, so we want to be sure that we have enough money to enjoy our lifestyle today.
That's it for this week. Join me again for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
There we are. That's the Irish anthem. You know, just in memory, we were talking about Des Dalton a while ago. We're going to be talking a little bit with Zafar Bengash, but I want to announce that Ken Stone, Syria Solidarity Movement, is going to be speaking on the 14th at Betsatoon. By the way, go to the Betsatoon site so you get all the details. It's 612 Markham at 7 p.m. And Ken visited Syria and has written I guess I'm going to call it a book pamphlet, Defiant Syria, and it's produced by the Syrian Solidarity Movement. Ken was at Palmyra, and listeners might remember we celebrated the victory of the Syrian army over the terrorists at Palmyra, and it a World Heritage Site. We like to say, and certainly here at the Taylor Report, it's significant when states are able to crush foreign-sponsored terrorists who go out of their way to commit heinous crimes. And it's very important that there be international solidarity with the people of Syria in their struggle. And so it's important to attend and hear Ken Stone's talk at Betsatoon. And that's on the 14th at 7 p.m. But I would advise you to go to the Betsatoon site to get the information exactly right. But we're joined now by Zafar Bengash. You're there, Zafar.
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you very much, Zafar. There was, we've been anxious to talk to you because you are an authority on a region which changes overnight.
Yes, of course. And thank you very much. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And I guess let's start with the more sort of this personality, Mr. Adoyan. I'm reading today, and as a matter of fact, I saw it in Crescent, -online.net, that Adoyan seems to be, one, he's a little bit unstable, but the other thing is that the world around him is not exactly stable, which would make his instability more interesting. But there's talk of his trying to alter the political system to make it kind of what they call a presidential system.
Yes.
And now, why would he be doing it? What is his? Why is he so desperate to have power? What is it he's trying to accomplish?
Essentially, he's one of those persons who has these megalomaniac ambitions. He thinks that he is indispensable to Turkey. He has these visions of reviving the Ottoman Empire and becoming a modern-day sultan or the king. Although he does have popular support in the country, but the fact that he has these visions of grandeur. I mean, one of the ways that one can measure it in is that he had built a palace in Ankara, which has 1,000 rooms or more in it. And obviously, you can imagine for that, it cost $1 billion.
Yes.
He wants, those kinds of...
he's building the throne before the country.
That is correct, yes. Yeah. Yes, and in fact, at the present time, Turkey is going through a difficult period because its economy is in difficulty. The attack at Istanbul airport further undermined the tourism industry. In fact, the tourism industry, which is a major source of income for Turkey, has declined considerably because of the instability in Turkey, largely as a result of the policies that Erdogan has pursued vis-a-vis Syria and other neighbors. And so tourists have had to flee. Mm-hmm. Since 2014, there have been a number of bomb explosions. As I mentioned, the latest one was at Istanbul airport that killed something like 40, 50 people or perhaps more. Mm-hmm. And so that is a very, very sort of sensitive area. Because almost all tourists to Turkey industry has taken a very, very hard hit. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the instability that Erdogan was creating for Bashar al-Assad in Syria has actually come to haunt him inside Turkey itself.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Zafer Bengash, crescent-online.net. Now, he's sort of apologized to the Russians for shooting down their plane, but many people are wondering, well, okay, that's sort of a step that might help reduce tensions. But the issue really between himself and Syria and Russia as an ally of Syria is his permitting, I shouldn't say permitting, encouraging and sending terrorist fighters across his border. Is there any indication he might stop?
Well, he joined the American campaign in the sense that he said, okay, now we're going to support only quote-unquote moderate rebels. Mm-hmm. We know that there is no such animal as a moderate rebel.
Yeah. By the way, he's not actually qualified as a moderate to know a moderate if he saw one, is he?
Exactly.
How moderate? We just described. He doesn't seem very moderate.
That's correct. So basically what this has done is, I mean, he's realized that this whole Syria policy has turned into a fiasco. It's not getting anywhere. Bashar al-Assad is not on the verge of being overthrown. The terrorists that he and his army and intelligence agency have been supporting have not made, a great deal of progress. In fact, all the news coming out of Syria as well as Iraq is that the terrorists are on the defensive. They have mm-hmm. lost considerable territory around Aleppo as well as Manbij, which is a Kurdish town. And then the Syrian army is making progress towards Raqqa, which is the capital of the terrorist mm-hmm. groups. They're about something like 25 kilometers outside Raqqa, the Syrian army. And the Kurdish groups that have surrounded Manbij, another city which is west of Raqqa and close to the Turkish border, again, that has exerted tremendous pressure on these terrorist groups because now they can neither get weapons from being smuggled through Turkey, nor can they get these terrorists being smuggled from there. Mm-hmm. So it is increasing pressure on the terrorist groups inside Syria. And so the policy that Erdogan was pursuing, that he could continue to supply the terrorists endlessly, is appears on the verge of being stopped completely. So if those terrorists are completely surrounded in Raqqa as well as Manbij, then that means that that would be a major blow to the policy that Erdogan and his allies in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, etc., mm-hmm. together with the Americans and other NATO countries have been pursuing, is going to be brought to an end. Mm. And so now Erdogan is trying to recoup some of the losses, and in fact, he took two steps. The first was that he apologized to the Russians, although the Russians are not particularly impressed by that apology.
So, yes.
Because they see that this is just a hypocritical game that he's playing.
Well, you know the proverb, I hear what you say, but I see what you do.
Exactly. So, and the second thing is that he's also, made up with the Israelis. In mm-hmm. fact, he's sort of accepted a deal that Israel had offered, that Israel would pay $20 million in compensation for the 9 members of the Mavi Marmara that were attacked by Israeli commandos in international waters on May the 31st of 2010. That boat was sailing towards the Gaza Strip, carrying provisions like food and clothing for children and medicines. There were absolutely no weapons or anything like that, and yet the Israeli commandos violated international law. They attacked the boat in international waters.
That was an amazing episode.
Absolutely.
We were all stunned when that
happened. Exactly. And they murdered nine of those passengers, and scores of others were badly wounded. And, of course, that led to Erdogan breaking off diplomatic relations with Israel. But now, this was announced last week that, or a couple of weeks ago, that Erdogan was restoring relations with them and that he had accepted $20 million in compensation from Israel for the victims' families. Mm-hmm. Although the passengers on the Mavi Marmara and those that lost their loved ones are completely livid by this deal that Erdogan has struck, because they said that we have not been consulted. We did not want money. We wanted the Israeli leaders and the Israeli military personnel that were involved in these crimes and giving the orders that they should be prosecuted as war criminals. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there is plenty of evidence to convict them as war criminals. But because of Erdogan's own vulnerability at home and the failure of his policies, then he's trying to sort of mend fences with the Israelis, hoping that that would save him from further humiliation and further weakening of his grip on power.
Yeah. Now, by the way, inevitably, he every time he takes one of these steps, he does have a sort of unravels a little bit, doesn't he, in his power? And I just want to ask in relation to that, because this came up in an earlier interview with Murray Dobbin about NATO and Canada's sort of going along automatically. There is a level at which NATO, for example, it's your friend, but it's also penetrates your military. Turkey's part of NATO. I wonder how much that military actually listens to him.
In Turkey, obviously, there is a very, very uneasy relationship between the civilian leadership and the military. At the present time, Erdogan has got his own people in the top positions in the military. So he's relatively okay from that angle. Although we should not discount the possibility that there could be a coup against him, because the Turkish military is a very powerful institution. It has very, as you mentioned, it is a NATO member. It has very close links with them. Also, the Turkish military has very close links with the Israeli military. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, there is...
They live their own private life.
Exactly. And unfortunately, the militaries in most Muslim countries are like that, that they are above the law. They operate according to their own whims and wishes, and they don't really care much for the civilian leadership or whatever policies they may formulate. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that we can discount that Erdogan has been able to subdue the military completely. Mm-hmm. And there could be a possibility if things go terribly wrong inside Turkey, as they are heading in that direction, mm-hmm. because the economy is not doing too well. It's been further undermined by the tourism industry taking a big hit. Mm-hmm. His policy vis-a-vis Syria has unraveled. He has taken on the Kurdish groups unnecessarily, antagonized them, and launched attacks against them. That's a very, very foolish policy. But that was purely because he wanted to gain points and arouse Turkish nationalism to win the last election in November. Mm. And so these are some of the aspects that are likely to come to the fore if, let's say, the situation in Turkey continues to deteriorate, particularly on the security front as well as on the economic front.
Yeah. Thank you. We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. And Zafar, you've touched on something at Crescent that, again, this is shocking, but I wonder if it's also a sign of the decline perhaps or problems for the Saudi regime. They have reached out to connect themselves to have a meeting in Paris with the outfit called the MKO.
That's correct, yes.
Who were Saddam's old friends, that Saddam and the United States were nurturing these people to attack Iran.
Yes, exactly.
The Saudis are showing up publicly alongside them?
Absolutely. Like, you know,
what is that?
The Saudis are getting so desperate that they realize that their terrorists that they have unleashed in Syria as well as in Iraq are being gradually degraded. In fact, in Iraq, as you know, the city of Fallujah has been liberated from the terrorist clutches. Now the Iraqi army is heading towards Mosul. So on that front, the Saudis have had a complete failure. Now they're moving out and sort of striking an alliance with this group, the MKO, which is a well-known terrorist group that were involved in bombings and assassinations and planting bombs and et cetera. And they've killed at least 1,200 leading figures in Iran members of parliament, ministers, chief justice, prime minister, president, you name it. I mean, they killed all kinds of people. And of course, the Iranian government had to deal with them firmly.
And they used to be on the terror list.
Exactly.
And then just overnight, the Americans said, no, no, they're not terrorists anymore.
Yeah, because they are our terrorists. So they're not on the
Giuliani, the former presidential candidate, a right-wing thug in America, and John McCain.
Yeah.
They went to Paris meetings, too. I noticed, by the way, the MKO seems to be the boss. They put on very grand shows.
Exactly.
They look like some kind of modern art show.
Exactly.
And people sort of float into the meetings, everyone's sitting with his glass of water and wonderful tables. A ton of money is involved with those people.
Sure. And it was Turki Al-Faisal, the former Saudi intelligence chief, who appeared on the platform with them, and he openly said that he supports this terrorist group's campaign to overthrow the legitimate government in Iran. I mean, he openly said it, and this was and his speech was given extensive coverage in the Saudi media. So it was not anything done surreptitiously. It was done openly and publicly. And here is this, you know, a very senior figure in the Saudi regime calling for the overthrow of a legitimately established government of Iran. And so that means that Turki Al-Faisal is actually consorting with terrorists. He's supporting terrorist groups, and he's calling for the overthrow of a legitimately established government in Iran. Mm-hmm. And so this is an open declaration of war against Iran, and obviously it is going to have implications and repercussions. And I feel, you know, quite deep down that the Saudis are really teetering on the brink. That's why they are clutching at straws. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done these desperate things and these despicably desperate things, yes, to be consorting with
the bombing of Yemen.
Exactly. Completely. They have destroyed that poor country, and they're not getting anywhere with their bombing campaign. In fact, you know, they have not been able to dislodge the Houthi militias. They are still completely in control of the capital city. And, you know, there are peace negotiations or talks going on in Kuwait. They started in April, but they haven't got very far. So on all fronts, we see that the Saudis have failed. And so you see their desperate moves in aligning themselves or joining hands with the terrorists, etc.
Well, you summed that up nicely. Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. Zafar, thank you very, very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
...2016 marks Between the Lines' 25th year on the air. As we celebrate our all-volunteer independent media project's anniversary, please consider subscribing to our podcasts and supporting our work. Visit our website at btlonline.org, that's btlonline.org, for details on how to subscribe and make a contribution.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Graylin Hagler, senior pastor at the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ, who examines why Americans remain so divided on issues of police accountability and race after a week of tragic violence. Author, activist, and journalist David Swanson, who summarizes the conclusions of the British Chilcot Iraq War Report and considers the lack of any similar inquiry here in the U.S. to investigate the conduct of the Bush administration. And Caitlin Parody, communications director with the group Toxics Action Center, who talks about the effort to incorporate climate justice mandates into the New England Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Ethnic violence erupted in South Sudan in late June as victims reported attacks by army soldiers and fighters targeting neighborhoods in the city of Wau, where ethnic Fatit people live. A Fatit government worker told The Guardian newspaper, "We saw soldiers from the Sudan People's Liberation Army shooting at civilians. Dozens of civilians were killed in the attack, and 70,000 people were forced to flee their homes." The civil war in South Sudan, which began in December 2013, has been dominated by attacks on civilians. In the capital city of Juba, over 300 people were killed in early July in a weekend of battles between militias, some loyal to President Salva Kiir and others to Vice President and former rebel leader Riek Machar, raising new doubts of the durability of a 2015 peace agreement. A researcher based in South Sudan observed, "There is no peace deal, only delaying tactics by the government. The state is continuing its military operations against the predominantly non-Dinka people." In recent months, humanitarian groups have complained that the United Nations peacekeeping force in South Sudan has failed to safeguard civilians in designated protection zones. Doctors Without Borders condemned the ineffectiveness of the peacekeepers, stating the Blue Helmets failed to protect the civilians as the United Nations Security Council mandated they should. South Korean labor leader Han Sang-kyun of the Korean Federation of Trade Unions was sentenced to 5 years in prison after he organized a series of unauthorized protest rallies in 2015. The harsh sentence reveals a growing level of authoritarianism in the Asian nation. The government charged Han with 8 traffic and public safety violations, claiming the leader of the 800,000-member labor federation tried to incite violence by exhorting the crowd to march to the presidential palace during an anti-austerity protest. In response, riot police blocked streets and tried to disperse protesters with water cannons. After the rally, Han took refuge in the Jogi Buddhist temple, where he stayed for 24 days before turning himself in to police. Labor unions in South Korea have been in retreat since the late 1990s, when the government made it easier to fire workers and to hire casual employees. Today, 1 in 7 South Korean workers makes less than the minimum wage of $5.15 an hour. President Park Geun-hye, the daughter of a former military dictator, outlawed a 200,000-member teachers' union for defending 20 activists who had been fired for union activity. One of Park's aides funneled funds from a big business lobby to a far-right group that routinely mounted counter-protests to rallies by union and political activists. Juvenile prisons have been part of the penal landscape for most of America's history. As far back as the early 1800s, reformers pushed for the removal of children detained in harsh prison conditions. New institutions were created for the detention of youth in what were then called houses of refuge. But the new juvenile prisons failed, as they became overcrowded fortresses riddled with abuse. So reformers again advocated for change, establishing new youth camps or youth development centres, but harsh conditions remained. According to The Nation magazine, juvenile justice reform did make progress in 2015. Some state legislatures moved aggressively to remove young people from adult prisons. But despite those efforts, today some 10,000 youths are held in adult prisons where they are 5 times more likely to be sexually assaulted than in juvenile institutions. Juvenile justice reformers are hoping to move public opinion to support the closing of large youth prisons and expand alternatives to incarceration, such as probation and counseling services. Critics complain that a prison environment, isolated from family and community, results in trauma, more recidivism, and a pipeline into the adult criminal justice system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
After 2 years of focus on police violence, protests, and debate, America just witnessed a tumultuous week, which began with the police shooting deaths of Philando Castile in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, and Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Both incidents, documented in part on smartphone video recordings, went viral across American social media and around the globe. The police shootings of these two African-American men were followed by the murder of 5 police officers and the wounding of 7 others in Dallas, Texas, during a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest march. The sniper attack was carried out by a lone U.S. Army veteran who told police negotiators before his death that he was angry about recent police violence. In remarks made in Dallas during a memorial service for the slain officers on July 12th, President Obama said, "Hope does not arise by putting our fellow man down. It is found by lifting others up. And that's what I take away from the lives of these outstanding men," he said. "I believe our sorrow can make us a better country. I believe our righteous anger can be transformed into more justice and more peace." But other voices on the right were not on the same page as the president. Conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh declared that activists in the Black Lives Matter movement were terrorists. And former Republican New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani asserted that the Black Lives Matter movement is inherently racist and that the group puts a target on the backs of police officers. Following the police shootings, Black Lives Matter protests were held in dozens of cities across the U.S., with the participation of tens of thousands. In some cities, civil disobedience actions resulted in hundreds of arrests. Your reporter spoke with Graylin Hagler, senior pastor at Washington, D.C.'s Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ. Here, Reverend Hagler examines why Americans remain so divided on the issues of police accountability and race after a week of tragic violence.
We have to thank Black Lives Matter for remaining in the streets and remaining in people's faces and continuing to press the issue and to lift up the issue and to carry on strategies and confrontations that continue to remind the overall society that things are not well and that there are things that have to be addressed. Because one thing that most Black people and people of color understand in this country does not talk about race unless it's forced to talk about race. That is America's best kept secret, but at the same time, America's greatest sin is that they do not talk about their greatest sin, and they try to make it something else, and they try to deny that there is any racism involved, and they want to call it something else. And that's part of the problem, is that America has never confronted its problems with race and its issues around racism.
Reverend Hagler, following the most recent police shooting deaths of the Black men in Minnesota and Louisiana, the debate in this country often devolves into a divisive and polarized argument where many people believe they have to choose sides to either support the Black Lives Matter protesters or support the police. But of course, there is another option. People can support the police and support changes in our system of policing that will reduce this kind of police violence and the feeling of many people in poor communities that the police are an occupying army.
People don't have any problem supporting the police as long as the police are engaged in righteous actions. In the eyes of the Fraternal Order of Police, police never do anything wrong, and that's part of the problem. Everybody in the police departments are not correct. Everybody in the police department is not biased, right? I mean, you know, the fact is that there's always a diversity, and clearly people have to call it for what it is. And unfortunately, part of the polarizing discussion and the debate becomes those who are protecting law enforcement, those who are representing law enforcement, are basically arguing to the extreme and pretending as if there's nothing wrong in the police department. Also, we've witnessed over the last number of years the radical militarization of civilian police departments, and what I mean domestic police departments. For example, what happened in Dallas should be really of concern to folks, that you put a bomb on a robot that went in and blew somebody up. That should be really real concern. Where did the bomb come from? Is the bomb stored in a warehouse somewhere? What else is stored in a warehouse somewhere? We should all be asking these questions because this is part of the problem why police are seen as an occupying army because of the severe militarization that goes on. And the fact is that if you got it, you're going to use it. And unfortunately, it's been used too much.
Well, just a final question for you, Reverend Hagler, and that is, as you look at the national Black Lives Matter movement dispersed across hundreds of cities all across this country, what would be your priority in terms of organizing for action and a list of demands in terms of the situation in our country today?
Well, I think that you got the list of demands obviously should be to really construct a whole model of community policing. Two, that the police departments be under the scrutiny of the federal government, of an agency in the federal government, where they will have to report gun discharges, have to report the arrest rates and who is being arrested and who is being detained, who is being stopped, who is being shot down. So that we have an indication of who is doing what out there. The other thing that is clear is that folks need to be submitted to all kinds of psychological testing to be able to realize who is actually equipped to be of service and who should not. And also, the other issue is that we should not be supplying police departments out of surplus equipment that has come off the battlefields of Iraq and the battlefields of Afghanistan, and the grants to buy those kinds of weaponry that really begins to set you up as an assault unit rather than as a policing unit. And yes, of course, people should be come out of the local communities and should have the opportunities to come out of the local communities and serve.
That was Reverend Graylin Hagler, senior pastor of the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. For more perspectives on the issues of police violence and racial division, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After 7 years, an independent investigation into the events surrounding the decision taken by former British Prime Minister Tony Blair to join the U.S. in launching the disastrous 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq has finally completed its work. The inquiry, named for Sir John Chilcot, the retired civil servant who was appointed by Tony Blair's successor, Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown, in 2009, to look into how the decision to enter the war was made, as well as the military conflict itself and its aftermath. These were among the findings of the report. The UK chose to join the invasion before peaceful options had been exhausted. Prime Minister Blair deliberately exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein and promised George Bush that he would be with him in the war, whatever. Other conclusions reached in the report included Britain's intelligence agencies produced flawed information, the UK military was ill-equipped for the task, and the government did not try hard enough to keep a tally of Iraqi civilian casualties. Your reporter spoke with David Swanson, author, activist, and journalist, who helped combat the U.S. corporate media blackout on the so-called British Downing Street memo that spelled out how the intelligence and facts justifying the Iraq war were to be fixed around the policy. Here Swanson summarizes the conclusions reached in the Chilcot report and considers the fact that the U.S. has had no similar inquiry to hold members of the George W. Bush administration accountable for their decision to launch the Iraq war under false pretenses and the subsequent commission of war crimes, including subjecting U.S.-held detainees to torture.
If you look at the details, the so-called findings, I mean, there's almost nothing new there that we didn't already know, much of it, you know, for a decade or more. But it establishes very clearly that Prime Minister Tony Blair was informed by his top advisors that the United States was intent on war, you know, at least a year before Blair or Bush led on to that fact, that the United States was lying about the justifications for the war, that Iraq had and could have no nuclear weapons, that if Iraq had any chemical or biological weapons, the only way it would use them would be if it were attacked, and the only way it would distribute it to them to any terrorists would be if it were attacked. that numerous other nations were of much greater concern than Iraq, North Korea among them, that attacking Iraq would be illegal, that an authorization from the United Nations did not exist and would be required. And, of course, they spent months trying to get one and didn't. So it's a very damaging document. It also makes clear that the Joint Intelligence Committee in Britain, the so-called intelligence advisors, informed Blair and his cabinet that attacking Iraq would endanger the United Kingdom, would create chaos and disorder and terrorism rather than tamping down on it or protecting the United Kingdom and the United States. So they knew it would be counterproductive. They knew it would produce something like the disaster it produced. So when Blair says now we wanted to save the Iraqi people from an evil dictator and bring them democracy, but they just weren't ready for it, and they went and destroyed their country, and we tried to help them, but they weren't mature enough to accept our help. You know, this is a new pile of lies. Right, because at the time, he admitted that overthrowing a government was illegal and pretended the war was about ridding Iraq of weapons that he knew it probably didn't have. And the idea that he had no reason to expect that the war would lead to something negative, you know, is disproven by the report. So, you know, all of which we already knew, and we knew from day one that Britain was a big accomplice in this crime, perhaps the greatest crime of the past 40 years, regardless of what excuses were made or who was being honest or who was lying. You know, possessing weapons is not a justification for a war and never could have been. So, you know, now we've done the report. They've dragged it out as long as they possibly could. Now we need accountability.
What is the next step in this report, given the fact that I just read that members of Parliament are calling for a vote to determine if Tony Blair is guilty of contempt of Parliament? Is that part of this process, and where do you think it will go?
Yeah, Jeremy Corbyn, who is a terrific peace activist who had this right back in 2003 and earlier and ever since, and is now the leader of the Labour Party, has signed on to this measure that would hold Tony Blair in contempt or convict him of being contemptuous to Parliament, or however they phrase it, and, you know, which is not a prosecution in a criminal court. It's not even exactly an impeachment, which is still possible as well, but it potentially carries the same penalty that might follow an impeachment and trial, which is barring Tony Blair from ever again holding public office. This is one of the things that could be done to George W. Bush or Dick Cheney or any other U.S. official, and in both Britain and the U.S., people have been impeached in the past after having left office, and you can deny them benefits, deny them the right to ever hold office again, and so forth, but more importantly, condemn them publicly for their behavior.
As we look at the Chilcot report in Britain, it's obvious that the United States has had no similar investigation into the events surrounding the Bush administration's launch of the Iraq war. And upon taking office, President Barack Obama said famously, when he was asked about investigating the potential war crimes that occurred under the Bush administration, he said he was going to look forward and not look back. And the option of investigating what happened, not only about the Iraq war, but the torture that had been documented of U.S.-held prisoners, those issues have been taken off the table by Barack Obama himself. I wonder, David, if you would talk about any potential for an investigation to hold officials accountable and the danger you see in having elected officials who operate above the law and unaccountable to the public.
Yeah, it's really embarrassing and shameful that, you know, an accomplice or really almost a bit player in the biggest crime of the past 40 years or so, you know, is pursuing some modicum of accountability, some sort of truth and reconciliation to a very limited degree, and already in that process saw the results of having Parliament vote against a prime minister's demand for war for the first time in centuries 3 years ago with the proposal to send missiles into Syria. You know, whereas in the United States, there's nothing of the sort. And in fact, a woman I won't mention who couldn't get a nomination for president in the Democratic Party 8 years ago because she had voted for the invasion of Iraq now looks like she can. You know, there's this degree of forgetting because there hasn't been any accountability. And you have a candidate, another candidate I won't mention, actually running on a platform of more torture. Because the various atrocities, the murder and torture and imprisonment and spying during the course of this war have been treated as policy options, not as the crimes that they were.
That was activist and journalist David Swanson, whose books include War is a Lie and When the World Outlawed War. For more analysis of the Chilcot Report, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, also known by its acronym REGGI, includes all the New England states plus New York, Maryland, and Delaware in a cap-and-trade program to reduce carbon emissions region-wide and raise money from the sale of pollution permits to fund green energy projects. The concept is that the cap on allowable emissions progressively decreases, thus reducing pollution. But critics say the problem with this and similar cap-and-trade programs is those very pollution permits, which allow companies to continue pouring both climate and ground-level pollution into the air, are mostly located in communities that are already heavily burdened by such pollution and are often low-income communities of color. Now an organization wants to use the program review process of REGGI to push for including protections for these communities and to prioritize the funds raised to clean up the worst pollution, giving these communities a say in how the funds are spent. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Caitlin Parody, communications director with the group Toxics Action Center, who explains how a coalition of groups is working to make sure these climate justice initiatives are incorporated into the REGGI process going forward.
This issue of fossil fuel pollution and climate change has really become a very important part of our work because of the experiences that frontline communities are having. And right now, REGGI is actually going through a program review. And so we have been involved in forming a loose coalition to really take advantage of this moment and campaign to make sure that as the program evolves, we see really tough limits on pollution and that we see low-income communities, communities of color, and communities where fossil fuel infrastructure or environmental injustice have been concentrated, that they really have a say in what REGGI looks like and how it's implemented and that they benefit from the program. And I think part of, you know, what that speaks to is this question of, okay, so you're driving down overall carbon pollution through REGGI, that's great, but do we have local hotspots where maybe actually you have a lot of companies that are buying these permits instead of cleaning up their act in particular communities? And so one of the things that we really want to make sure is that that concern is really honored and heard, and that as we go through this program review, an environmental justice analysis that includes, you know, analyzing proximity and cumulative impacts is part of the program review so that we can really make sure that, in fact, marginalized communities are benefiting from the program and not seeing any increase in localized emissions.
Caitlin Parody, I live in Connecticut, and we still have one coal-burning power plant left in Bridgeport, which the company is planning to replace in a few years with a gas-burning plant.
We have a long history of working in Bridgeport to help shut down Bridgeport Harbor Station. One of the asks that this loose coalition of groups is making is really that we set a stringent cap, overall cap on pollution. The specific ask is to set a cap that goes down 5% from 2020 levels every year through 2030. And one of the things that a strong cap like that can do is really help make sure that coal-fired power plants can't stay open, or in particular that they won't be refired with gas. And so it helps send this market signal that fossil fuel, you know, isn't the way to go, and also does kind of deal with this transition question where we don't see some of these coal-fired power plants that are going offline all over New England refired with gas. And then the other piece of this that I think is just so critical and really like where a lot of our involvement stems from is that we really want to make sure that the RGGI process is accessible to frontline communities and communities that, like the community near the Bridgeport plant, that have just faced so much environmental injustice and lived with these smokestacks for years, so that they have a say both in how it's implemented and how its proceeds are distributed, and so that they're given assurance that a plant like Bridgeport isn't going to be more likely to stay open, isn't going to be able to buy all these permits or be refired with gas, you know, whatever it might be, that they have some assurances that they're going to have less pollution in their community because of RGGI. And then we also ask that the money made through RGGI, it should be heavily invested in communities that have dealt with the harmful health effects of fossil fuel power generation, again, like Bridgeport, and in programs that are really going to deliver benefits there.
I've talked to a lot of groups who are opposed to cap and trade, just opposed. Do you think your efforts are like putting lipstick on a pig, and that maybe it would be better to just oppose that system of pollution permits altogether and insist on, say, a straight-up carbon tax or carbon fee and dividend?
You know, I think that that's a totally valid critique, and there certainly are a lot of groups out there that are concerned that any trading program that allows polluters to buy permission to pollute is the status quo and is going to disproportionately harm low-income communities, communities of color, and the most vulnerable among us. So, you know, we do need a full paradigm shift. And right now we also have a real opportunity with the RGGI program update to make incremental change and get us closer to the world that we want to see.
That was Caitlin Parody, Communications Director with the Toxics Action Center. Learn more about the effort to incorporate climate justice mandates into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Rumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
A new Today, the events of last week continue to reverberate throughout national consciousness. The unprovoked killings by cops in the streets of America's Midwest and the subsequent killings of cops in Texas show us that a new stage has been reached in America's longest internal war, and that no one knows how it will end. The problem of police violence, of course, isn't new. When Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. led anti-segregation protests in Selma, Alabama, in the 1960s, cops didn't assist protesters. They beat them savagely for violating the unjust laws of white supremacy. They beat men and women indiscriminately to protect white privilege. The Edmund Pettus Bridge became slick with black blood. Today, they kill with utter impunity black men, women, and children like Mike Brown, Rakia Boyd, Tamir Rice, Eric Gardner. And nothing happens. Secret grand juries and not-so-secret judges repeatedly rule justified homicide, and killer cops get promotions. Good job, and nothing. Today, media, politicians, and police call Micah Xavier Johnson a madman, deranged, according to one prominent politician. But if he is mad, what made him so? Was he mad when he went to kill Afghanistanis on behalf of the empire? Perhaps they trained him too well. Oppression maddens people. It drives them mad. It turns calm brains into mad minds, consumed with anger, rage, and resentments. The media, ministers, and politicians will call him names, but he is beyond your curses now. His life was a curse already, to be born a nigger in America. That's curse enough. In 1951, the great poet Langston Hughes, in his poem Harlem, wrote, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode?" From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Maroon Schultz, after many years of hard struggle, has prevailed on his action to bar the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections from ever holding him in isolation again. In a remarkable settlement bringing an end to Schultz v. Wetzel, Maroon won on all counts. The only thing lacking is a judge's written opinion. Upon learning of the settlement, Maroon stated, "I have nothing but praise for all of those who supported me and my family for all the years I was in solitary confinement, as well as helped to effect my release. Since joining the struggle for human rights in the mid-1960s, I have always chosen to fight. Frederick Douglass was right when he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. So have no doubt that I see this settlement as anything but the latest blow struck, and you rest assured that I will continue in the struggle for human rights. Straight ahead, Russell Maroon Schultz." Under the terms of the settlement,
the DOC has agreed to not place Maroon in solitary over his prior disciplinary record. He is to be single-celled for life, and Maroon was granted a monetary settlement. Maroon was held in solitary confinement from 1983 to 2014, with the exception of 19 months he spent in federal custody at Leavenworth, where he lived in general population. So for 22 consecutive years, a lifetime, Russell Maroon Schultz has been held by the state of Pennsylvania in isolation, conditions described as torture by the United Nations Special Rapporteur Juan Mendez, who called for Maroon's release from solitary. Mendez served as a defense expert for Schultz. Russell Maroon Schultz was represented in this federal civil rights action by Brett Grote and Dustin McDaniel, Esquires of the Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh, Harold J. Engel, Esquire, and attorneys Rick Etter and Stephanie L. Burt of the law firm Reed Smith. The struggle continues, and sometimes you win. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Another one gone. And now comes another. Alton Sterling, father, husband, beloved of his family and friends, joins a tragic train of death. Mike Brown, Rekia Boyd, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, and on and on and on. All killed by cops just doing their jobs. At times like these, elections seem irrelevant, for they have no answer to this gnawing state of terror. No answer at all. Why should they? They were architects of it. They campaigned for these killers. They approved their militarization. The politicians running for office or running from office today were gung-ho for cops yesterday, sending them more and more of the people's tax dollars and more weapons of war. What did they expect? Now, within hours of Sterling's killing, another black man, Philando Castile, is gunned down in his car, sitting beside his lover, while reaching for his ID and registration demanded by a traffic cop. Another one gone. And another. And another. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Thank you.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour airs on radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. It also airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. It airs on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm and is podcast at the website globalresearch.ca. On June 23, 2016, citizens of the United Kingdom had a chance to cast judgment on the island country's place in the European region. The results sent shockwaves around the globe. England and Wales voted in favor of leaving the European Union, while Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to stay. Overall, Leave won over Remain by a vote of 52% to 48%. What does Brexit mean for the future of Great Britain, the EU, and for international politics generally? Wednesday, July 13th, in the city of Winnipeg at the Millennium Library downtown at 7:30 p.m., the venerable magazine Canadian Dimension assembled a panel of four thinkers to discuss what indeed has been unleashed by the shocking result. The moderator of the discussion was Canadian Dimension publisher and founder Cy Gonick. He pointed out that the referendum had the potential to change everything, hence the name of the discussion. So, for the duration of the next hour, here is that discussion: how Brexit changes everything. Professor Radhika Desai teaches politics at the University of Manitoba and is the director of Geopolitical Economy Research Group and a member of Canadian Dimension's editorial collective. Her latest book is entitled Geopolitical Economy After U.S. Hegemony, Globalization and Empire. Professor Desai led off the discussion.
First of all, as I say, Brexit is a symptom. What is it a symptom of? It's a symptom of the inequality, poverty, and deindustrialization that has plagued Britain for the last many decades. And by the way, it goes back to a time earlier than Mrs. Thatcher. Back in the 60s, people were beginning to worry about these issues. And in a certain sense, actually, Mrs. Thatcher's election and her free market policies were supposed to rectify this problem and make Britain competitive again and so on. They clearly failed, but this problem goes very far back. And a recent study by the BMJ shows that, in fact, the voting pattern in the last referendum, if you examine the voting patterns closely, what you find is that the correlation between the people who voted for leaving, the greatest correlation was actually between those areas that were most suffering from the problems of poverty, inequality, and deindustrialization, and it is the chatterati, shall we say, the professional middle classes who control the discourse in any society, were actually trying to stigmatize these people as essentially racist, that they were racist and they had voted in order to keep immigrants out. Secondly, it is a symptom of the financialization that has overtaken British society. One of the things that you must remember is that the core of the among the elites, of the support for the Remain side came from the City of London, and we shall presently see why that was the case. Thirdly, it is a symptom of how far the elites and the masses have drifted apart from each other. That is to say, the elites have lost control of what the masses think. They can no longer persuade the masses to, even enough of them, to think what they want them to think in order to win elections or referenda and so on. Furthermore, of course, it is a symptom of the disunity of the United Kingdom. Whenever you have inequality, it never evenly affects all parts of the country in the same way. On the contrary, inequality always has a regional dimension. And to a very important extent, this regional dimension was also manifested in the fact that different parts of the United Kingdom voted very differently, with Scotland and Northern Ireland voting very decisively in favor favor of Remain, while and London, of course, the greater London area remaining voting for Remain, while most of the rest of the country voted to leave. And of course, it is a symptom, and I hope to develop this point as well, it is a symptom of the fact that the ruling class has lost its nerve. It does not know what to do. Because think about it. There have been Euro referenda in many countries which have delivered a negative verdict, but they have been ignored. There have been second referenda, etc. You know, we are going to subject you to referenda until you give us the result that we wish to have. This has been the general philosophy of the European elites. The British political elite has not been able to muster the gumption to do it this time, and there are deep-seated reasons for that. So these are some of the things it is a symptom of. Why are these developments taking place? Basically, and again, I can only give you some elements of an answer, but the key points to bear in mind is that in Britain, neoliberalism has led directly to a hyper-financialization. If you look at any chart of capital flows, the United Kingdom, in terms of per capita international capital flows, is by far the greatest. There's a wonderful little book you should all read by Nicholas Shackson called Treasure Islands, in which, of course, he's talking about the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and Panama, of course, and all those places which are essentially places where rich people hide their money. But the one point he makes is the biggest treasure island of them all, the most important treasure island of them all, is the United Kingdom. So that's one thing to bear in mind. But the key point for us here to understand what this means at a kind of geopolitical level is that in the last two or three decades, especially since Mrs. Thatcher let loose the so-called big bang financial reforms in the late 1980s, Britain has become the financial bridge between the American financial system and the rest of the world. And since the launching of the euro in particular, it has been the bridge between the American-dominated, dollar-denominated international financial system, in which American banks predominate, and the increasingly financializing financial system of Europe. Okay, now this bridge is no longer useful. It's no longer necessary. The link, in fact, has broken down, because after 2008, basically what most people don't realize is one very fundamental fact. Ben Bernanke came up with the idea of the global savings glut. He basically said America in the first decade of the 21st century has a big deficit because the Asians are saving too much. When the big crisis happened, the 2008 crisis happened, George Bush, in fact, picked this up and ran with it. He said that the Asians lent us too much money. That's why we have the financial crisis. In reality, if you actually, again, map capital flows in terms of who was lending to whom, which were the countries in between whom the biggest capital flows were taking place, gross capital flows, not net flows, what you find is that the part of the world that had the biggest investment in the U.S. housing and credit bubbles was none other than Europe. That is why Europe suffered the most. The 2008 crisis laid the basis for the 2010 internal Eurozone crisis, and of course things have gone pear-shaped since then, even more pear-shaped since then. So the point is that international capital flows, which were primarily across the Atlantic, collapsed after 2008. They have since recovered, but they still remain, according to a recent McKinsey report, 60% short of their 2008 peak. Okay, 60% short. So what we are seeing is these European banks can no longer afford to invest in the various asset bubbles that are being blown up. So Sai is giving me 2 minutes, so I will just try to wrap up very quickly. So I will say, first of all, so to some extent, the city had become dependent on its European business, okay, particularly after the 2008 financial crisis. That is why you hear so much about the passporting rights and the city being so devastated at the Brexit vote, because it has become reliant on Euro business. And And the unfortunate thing is that now the city is more reliant on the Europeans than the other way around, because in fact there is good reason. If you are a big financier or big bank owner or whatever in Europe, you'd actually be quite happy to see the British leave. Why? Because they have been dominating the business, and if they are out of the picture, then the European banks can get more of the business that the British had been cornering. At the same time, of course, Britain has also recognized that the old EU-US link is no longer working, and despite the fact that President Obama publicly voiced objections to this, the UK joined the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which involves vast quantities of money. They clearly realize that this is the direction in which even financial business will have to turn. So, finally, I would say that because of this collapse, and given that the financial link was the most important link, Atlantic link in an economic fashion, we will also see the breakdown of Atlanticism. Now, I will just very quickly say, in the near future, the Tory party in government will try to, although Theresa May has taken office by insisting that Brexit is Brexit, actually, we will see that she will try very hard to ensure that Brexit is not Brexit. She will try to, in the name of leaving the EU, try to create a whole lot of other agreements which will try to preserve as much of what the city in particular would like to have preserved. It's not for nothing that she has spent most of her professional life before being an MP in the city. And her husband is, of course, a very important member of the city today. We will see the imposition of austerity by another name, but again, that will be rejected by the people. We will see finance-led growth, but that will prove unsatisfactory even to finance. We will see that the United Kingdom further disuniting, and of course, we will see tremendous attempts to try and discredit Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the Labour Party. I'll end here. Hopefully, we'll talk about some of the other points I have to make later, and I'm sure that's about where Alan would like to enter. So.
Alan Freeman is a transplanted Brit who relocated to Canada roughly 6 years ago. Alan Freeman was a principal economist with the Greater London Authority from 2000 to 2011. He is now retired and lives in Winnipeg, where he is co-director with Radhika Desai of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group.
Now, I'm going to start in a very strange place, which was a poem penned by a British diplomat in Washington in 1958, and then I'm going to explain it. This is a version of the Lord's Prayer, and it goes like this. Our uncle, which art in America, Sam be thy name. Thy navy come, thy will be done, in London as it is in Washington. Give us this day our martial aid, and forgive us our un-American activities, as we forgive your American activities against us. Lead us not into socialism, but deliver us from communism. For thine is our kingdom, the atom power, and the Tory, for ever and ever, G-men. Now, what does that poem tell us? It tells that the fate of the people of this continent and the fate of the people of, I would hardly call it a continent, let's say the island of Western Europe, is inextricably bound up by a web of steel and nuclear weapons that are organized by NATO. And the military connection and the role of Atlanticism in what is happening is something that can never be left out of the equation. Nuclear weapons were for Britain a bargaining chip to play the superpower in a world which was no longer their playground, because they were the first and the greatest imperial and colonial power. And that colonialism and imperialism survives to this day, and what we see now is not just a crisis of Europe, but a crisis of British imperialism, and with that, a crisis of US imperialism, because US and Britain are inextricably bound up through NATO, through the support that British nuclear submarines and British military naval bases throughout the world and British listening stations on the edge of Europe and British communication systems and Tony Blair's support for the Iraq war are indispensable to the war-making capacities of the Pentagon regime. So this is a crisis which impacts on all of us in this continent as well as that continent. I now want to quote, well, I can't, oh, here we go, from Tony Benn, who in 1973, when Edward Heath was trying to get into the common market, made the following speech. And what you have to remember is two incidents which you may not be aware of. The first, in 1963, Britain tried to get into the common market and were refused by a French veto. And the reason that they were refused was that just prior to that, there was an agreement in Nassau between the Americans and the British, in which the agreement made was that British submarines with American missiles would carry British nuclear warheads. And the French were excluded from that agreement. They were excluded from the technology of making nuclear weapons. And for 30 years, they were outside of NATO because of that. They set up their own independent Foster Frappe and developed their own independent nuclear weapons and so on. And this is what Tony Benn said. He, Edward Heath, this is in 1973 when he finally got in, went through the agony of negotiations before he failed in 1963. He did not fail because of the negotiations. He knows that he failed because of the Polaris deal at Nassau. At the very moment when de Gaulle wondered whether we had shifted from America to Europe, the then Prime Minister reaffirmed the special relationship, confirmed the exclusion of France from the nuclear partnership, and confirmed again the insult that de Gaulle had suffered when he asked for a triumvirate to run NATO, which was denied by America and Britain. My interpretation is that at that moment or soon after, the Right Honourable Gentleman, then a minister, in an outgoing government and now the Prime Minister, resolved that the nuclear weapon technology was the golden key to lift the French veto on British entry. It is not part of the terms, but an essential part of the deal. So Tony Benn takes up the cudgels in terms of opposing nuclear weaponry from Bevan and begins to found the basis of a new left, at which Corbyn is now the inheritor, which is why the real target for Corbyn is not actually European entry, but Trident missiles. And we should follow with anxiety and concern how the debate on nuclear missiles will work out. I just want to quote a few figures now which illustrate how important that relation was to Britain. And this is to the interwar period. When everybody thinks the empire was in decline, this is the proportion of British imports which were to the colonies of the former empire, that is, the so-called Commonwealth, India, Africa, you know all the places, right? That went up from 25% in 1913 to 37.4% in 1937. That was imports. Exports to empire went up from 32% to 39%. Britain was saved from the ravages of the Depression by cheap imports from the colonies and captive markets, and you can only preserve that if you are a military power. It could not continue to be a military power of the same scale after the war, because actually the country against which the war was really waged was Britain versus America, and America won, which is hence the poem. And so then from then on forced Britain to basically be the vassal state of America in Europe. That's the relationship which is now breaking down. Now that gave very quickly, I want to say a few things because I've only got 2 minutes. First of all revolutionary or seismic social processes happen at the points when empires break down. The Russian and German revolutions were a consequence of the failure of a nascent Russian imperialism and a far from nascent German imperialism to deliver. The French 1968 was absolutely a product of the failure of the Algerian War, and the whole French left was created by opposition to the nuclear war, to the Algerian War. The British left was very much created. My childhood, my whole formation was taken up by opposing what my country was doing in Africa, in India, and in Ireland. That was the formation of the British left. But the last point I want to make is to connect this up with what's now happening in Britain, which is the unique way in which the British ruling class is constructed, because the two forms of benefit that I mentioned, that is export and import, are the two dominant classes of British capital. There's a third class now rising, which is the financial class, which dominates London. Okay? But essentially, it's all tied up together. You have to run other people's countries if you're going to get cheap imports from them, send your exports from them, and make them take your money. Because the future of the pound is also in great doubt after all of this, and that's part of the system of domination. Now, those people are directly represented in the British political system. There's about 30% of the Tory party are actually themselves captains of industry. They don't represent themselves independently by means of the professional classes like in Britain. So the establishment, which is a deep-seated phenomenon in the British state, which reaches all the way down from the Tory party, Church of England, the senior civil service, and way into the Labour aristocracy. That's what runs Britain. The establishment blocks at every turn and uses every single dirty trick in its book to prevent the presentation at the head of the Labour Party, the head of the party of a working class, a leadership which will actually represent and stand for the interests of the working class instead of allowing it to be divided between black people and white, women and men, gays and non-gays. And there's been a 30-year experience, a learning experience within Britain, which I've been party to, where the trade unions have shifted from the bastions of the right wing, who backed Bevan, to being the people who are now campaigning and organising amongst people with no job, with no money. People are not the traditional fodder of the Labour Party. You have black sections, women's sections, gay sections, as part of their membership, with a voice on their executive, something I have never seen in Canada. That was part of this process of transformation. There's been a long learning process, and what we're seeing now is a leadership which has absorbed the lessons of that and which can win. So I think my title for the talk, everybody can suggest what their title might have been, but the real question is what next? That's always what next. And I'll tell you what next. Win.
Professor Henry Heller teaches history at the University of Manitoba. He is author of The Capitalist University, The Transformations of Higher Education in the United States. He's also a longtime associate of Canadian Dimension.
Of course, this particular Brexit crisis follows on the Greek crisis. People thought that the Greek crisis might be the breaking point in terms of the European Union, but as it turned out, it was the Brexit crisis. But I would remind you that these crises go back, for example, to 1995, when the introduction of the euro, the Dutch people and the French people voted against the introduction of the euro in 1995, and the politicians, the elites, the financial layer which controls the European Union simply ignored what the population in France and Europe wanted. Conclusion that the European Union is fundamentally undemocratic in character. It's a body which basically is run by these financial and political elites. And God bless the English, they have broken through. The English working class, who some people have slandered by calling them racist. In fact, it was a heroic protest against what was essentially a tyranny on the part of the European Union. In fact, I would argue that the European Union represents a throwback to a Europe prior to 1848 in terms of the reality of democracy in Europe exists at the present time. Yes, there are national governments and so on, but the real power lies in Brussels and the Bundesbank and these cliques of politicians and financiers who are really running the show, and the people have no say. And all of this, of course, comes as a result of this profound crisis that broke out in 2008, an endless crisis turning out to be. It goes on and on and on. I'll have a little bit more to say about it at the end. A crisis which is above all affecting the future of the younger generation all over the world. And is ravaging the young people. I want to talk about the relationship between the UK, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The UK was the cat's paw of the United States. It was the means by which the United States, both economically and militarily, was able to, in a way, strengthen its grip over the European Union. And so the Brexit has very important implications for the ability of the United States to continue to control Europe. Now, of course, that control is embodied above all in the NATO alliance. The European Union and the NATO alliance are the two key institutions of in Western Europe. Now, the United States, even before this happened, the as you undoubtedly noticed, the there has been in the last few years, and despite the protestation, the idealization of the president, President Obama, there's never been a more president who has been more aggressive and belligerent. The United States, we've seen a continuing intensification of U.S. militarism and imperialism in the last few years. That expresses itself in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, but also in the Middle East and with respect to China. Now, so that's basically what I see fundamentally then as an outcome of the Brexit. The a very important blow has been struck against the United States. But I want to talk about, just briefly in conclusion, I want to talk about Germany. And here we see a country which had benefited extraordinarily from the European Union. The European Union has been operating really to the benefit of Germany above all. But it seems to me, given the nature of the crisis, given the what has happened with Brexit, and given the malaise in the European Union, and given the world crisis, it seems to me that, and some of you may think I'm crazy, maybe I am crazy, but I feel that Germany is the place to watch, because Germany is dominant in Europe. In the last few weeks, we see that Germany has taken steps towards remilitarization, and that what I think is a possibility and what bears watching is the relationship between Germany and Russia. I know that right now Germany is echoing what Washington is saying vis-a-vis this, Russia and over the Ukraine, but in quiet areas, German politicians, German elites are discussing a rapprochement with Russia. Russia, which has in the last few years increasingly entered into a deep connection militarily and economically with China. And Germany has always been interested in Eastern Europe, always been interested in Russia, and it wouldn't surprise me at all. I'm not saying they're going to break with Washington tomorrow. I'm talking about the fundamental trends in the world. I believe that a rapprochement between Germany and Russia is by no means to be excluded. Finally, all of this is unfolding in the midst of a profound world crisis that we're into. And this I would just conclude by saying that this crisis is deeper than people imagine. They think that things are going to turn around tomorrow. That's not true. The crisis of world capitalism is institutional. It's a crisis of legitimization. It's an economic crisis, and it's an ecological crisis, and it is not going away. So I think the Brexit event signals that it's a political event, but it's an echo of deep tremors in the and a turning point in world history. Thank you.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour in the summer, broadcast on radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the site globalresearch.ca and also airs on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We're listening to a discussion on Brexit, convened at the Millennium Library in downtown Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada on July 13th, 2016. It was organized by Canadian Dimension magazine. The final panelist to present his opening remarks was John Ryan. John Ryan is a retired professor of geography at the and senior scholar at the University of Winnipeg and a longtime socialist. Here are his thoughts on how Brexit changes everything.
From my perspective, The decision by the majority of Britain's people to leave the EU was a really progressive move. Its long-term consequence may change history, not only in Britain, but in Europe and in the USA. It was a protest against the economic model that had been in place for the past three decades, as previous speakers have said. Indeed, it may alter the political, economic, and social landscape of the UK and Europe as well. Now, amazingly, the British people did not buckle, despite the brutal campaign conducted by politicians from both major political parties and the entire economic elite, to force them to reject the referendum, using all the means at their disposal, including mass media controlled by them. What they conducted was Project Fear, threatening them with all kinds of disasters if they should dare to question the status quo. But this campaign failed because of a fundamental mistake by the economic political establishment. They simply did not understand that for many Britons already living insecure and uncertain lives, they felt they had little to lose. The typical pay packet was the same now as it had been way back in 2008. They also underestimated the plain common sense of most working class people. These people were confronted with a situation where all the banks, the entire financial system, all the big businesses and multinational corporations, and the media controlled by them, all these entities were screaming that Britain had to stay in the European Union. And no mention was ever made of how this would actually help ordinary working class people, except that things would get worse if you don't look out. So don't ever even think of leaving the EU. Well, not surprisingly, working class people came to the correct conclusion. If this is great for the big banks, the financial institutions, and the multinationals, how could it possibly be good for us? And so the bulk of them voted to leave the EU. Now, in the aftermath of the Brexit revolution, there came the shock and awe of the political and economic establishment. An immediate smear campaign was conducted to try to discredit these unwashed masses who dared to question their betters in society. At first, they frantically put forward proposals on how to reverse the results of the referendum. But it wasn't easy to do. Now, all the serious commentators stressed the dangerous supposed reemergence of nationalism. Not only that, but the equally dangerous rise of anti-immigration feelings and the related rise of Islamophobia and xenophobia. Now, admittedly, right-wing political entities did harp on the anti-immigration issues, and probably many people did vote to leave the EU because of this. However, nobody could seriously suggest that the bulk of Britain's people are racist or xenophobic. The fact is that the Brexit is a victory for the victims of globalization, and as such, it's a class victory. However, class has to be redefined to include not just the old working class, which has diminished in Europe and especially in Britain as a result of deindustrialization, which is a result of globalization. Now, this is particularly so if one takes into account that Britain's rich are 64% richer than before the recession, while the poor are 57% poorer, all in a matter of 8 years. Overall, about 20% of the population is doing better, but 80% are doing much worse. So is there any wonder about the referendum vote? Brexit divided the country and both major political parties. It seems the people voted from the heart. Judging from interviews with ordinary people in the streets, they voted for fear of losing their jobs in a steady increase of globalization. They also out of anger against Brussels strong-arming their lives, and the impunity and secrecy by which the non-transparent European Union negotiates trade deals, which are primarily for the benefit of big business and multinational corporations. In Britain today, there are about 13 million people who live in poverty. This was a referendum in which an unprecedented number of voters took part, with a turnout of 72%. The Leave side led with 17.4 million, that's 52%, versus the Remain side of 16.1 million, or 48%. The geographical pattern of the vote reveals its class nature. In England, London was the only region to vote for Remain by 60 to 40%. Every other region voted to leave, 58% in Yorkshire and Humberside, 54% in Northwest, 59% in the Midlands, and more than 50% in the Southeast and Southwest. The areas in England and Wales where Brexit was victorious are exactly the areas populated by the victims of globalization, that is, victims of deindustrialization, imposed by multinational corporations who moved en masse to the exotic Chinese and Indian locations with low labor costs. Now, interestingly, Gordon Brown, who followed Tony Blair as leader of the Labor Party and who continued Blair's policies, somehow felt compelled to make the following statement in the aftermath of the referendum. Tony Blair said, "The elephant in the room is globalization, and the most obvious manifestation of the world we have lost is the hollowing out of our industrial towns as a result of the collapse of manufacturing in the face of Asian competition. These towns are home to a disproportionate share of semi-skilled workers who have not surprisingly become recruits in an anti-globalization movement." And that was by Gordon Brown. Now, the age pattern of the vote shows its significance with respect to ideological and cultural globalization. There was a turnout of 82% among those aged 55 and over, but barely a third of the group from ages 18 to 24 bothered to vote. Now, this younger group were fanatically opposed to Brexit, but when they were asked to explain their fanatical support, they usually were at a loss to explain it. Now, when the dust settles, Brexit should bring about a new dimension, a new perspective for all people of Europe. According to different surveys, it appears that a clear majority of people in Europe are opposed to the EU. In fact, Brexit may very well be the first step in a series of similar referenda, ranging from France, Hungary, Austria, Italy, Spain, Greece, and more. That alone could be the death knell for the EU. One wonders why it is that many people who consider themselves left-wing, why they have such difficulty grasping that the EU is a deeply reactionary institution. In the EU, the unelected officials have usurped the power of national governments and have asserted their right to determine the fates of countless millions through adherence to the damaging creed of neoliberalism. They have brought suffering on a massive scale, casting millions into poverty. They have foisted austerity on unwilling populations. What the EU did to Greece should have dispelled forever the fanciful idea that the EU had some real interest in the material welfare of ordinary people. In Greece, it brought about the destruction of an entire country, the decimation of industries, and the forced sell-off of public infrastructure and slashing of social services, all to please European banks and creditors. Now, in Spain, 20% of the workers are unemployed. Few realize that combined with the USA, the European Union had contributed to the disaster in Ukraine. The Ukraine debacle started when the European Union strong-armed tactics to get Ukraine to sign an economic treaty and break off relations with Russia, which would have cost Ukraine $160 billion. They also had to cooperate with the European Union militarily. So that's why Yanukovych refused to sign the agreement. And we all know what that led to, the U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat and the disaster that followed. And the West, with the West propaganda, diabolical propaganda campaign, that's blamed Russia for all of this. Now, some people have worried that if Britain withdrew from the EU, a conservative government would enact devastating restrictions and an austerity program which would make things worse. Well, let's hope the conservatives do that. This would ensure a majority government for Labour, headed by Jeremy Corbyn. The landslide election of Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the Labour Party last year indicates there's a widespread support for a socialist alternative to right-wing politics that Britain has endured for the last 30 years. It's highly likely that a Corbyn-Labour government may very well be elected in the future. It's significant that Corbyn wants Britain out of NATO. Now, that would be a big thunderclap, wouldn't it? Also, with Britain leaving the EU, it will weaken NATO, and it will lessen America's grip on the EU. So this is a chance of a lifetime to break with Washington-led dominance, with NATO, the eternal wars on terror, the destruction, balkanization of the Middle East. So it's a good cause to celebrate the Brexit vote.
Immediately after the opening statements, a discussion ensued between the panelists.
Very quickly, I just wanted to add to a very important point that Henry raised, which is about Germany. I think that one of the implications, I think, of the possible breaking of the transatlantic link is indeed that Germany's foreign policy will increasingly become independent. And as Henry says, this is something we have to watch because it's not necessarily going to take a progressive turn, but at the moment it does look good in the sense that increasingly Germany and German politicians, there was a very important statement, for instance, by the German foreign minister recently about how we should tone down the rhetoric on Ukraine, etc. So on Ukraine in particular, which is a very important flashpoint in Europe, Germany is increasingly asserting its independence, and I think that's something to watch. A small point I would also like to make is that I think we really have to understand how completely unconnected with the mass of the mass base of the Labour Party, the Parliamentary Labour Party has become, to the extent that some of the press are reporting that the part of the reason why they staged and continued with this revolt against Corbyn was in order to bury the coverage, the very damning coverage of the Chilcot Inquiry. Because the Chilcot Inquiry said a number of extremely critical things. While, yes, it did not say that Blair had lied, but then I don't think you expect an establishment inquiry to say that a member of the establishment had lied. But the fact is that the things were so bad that they were forced to issue a series of extremely damning judgments on the decision to go to war in Iraq, the way in which the way in which the evidence was presented, mishandled, etc., and I think this would have actually put the Blairites in an extremely bad light. It is extremely delegitimizing. We are at a stage today when Tony Blair can be tried as a war criminal. The Chilcot Inquiry did not say whether the war was illegal or not, but there are, I mean, lots of people. Jean Chrétien said the war was illegal. So there are many, many reasons for this to happen, and the Blairites were really just covering their back. I'll just say that for now.
I find myself in a minority, and I would beg to respectfully differ, as obviously the only Brit here, with some of the tones of what have been said. There is nothing progressive about the nationalism of an imperialist power under any circumstances whatsoever. And by the way, that includes Canada. Okay? all the reasons that John gave as to why disaffected workers in the regions of Britain voted for Brexit are the same reasons that Donald Trump supporters are supporting. Every single one of them. Not one of the reasons you gave differs. Second, it's not true that there was some kind of unanimous, all-sweeping vote. It's not true that the people of London are financiers. 13 million people live in the Greater London area. The great majority of them are poor. There is a huge presence of non-white people and people of Irish descent and people of second-generation descent. These are people who have fought a bloody battle on the streets of London against the kind of racist rubbish that poured out during that campaign. This was not a threat of racism. It's damn well happening. I have not seen stores torched. I have not seen people turfed off trains for carrying bags in which Yiddish words were inscribed in my life. This is a real thing. It is not true that the British, the capitalist class is lined up behind it. In actual fact, all the yellow press, all the press barons, were enthusiastically in favour of exit, and they were the ones who actually whipped up. It's not true the great majority of Scottish people voted to stay in. The great majority of the people in the north of Ireland voted to stay in. The great majority of young people wanted to stay in. 63% of Labour Party supporters voted to stay in. There's not some kind of unanimous national liberation movement. What we've got is a breakup. We have a crisis. That it's absolutely true, and I agree with all the speakers on this, that the old Europe simply cannot carry on, because you cannot unify a territory or a people on the basis of crushing them. It's very simple. I mean, Canada and America have to watch out for this, because you have to have fiscal redistribution in order to create genuine unity, and that can only be created from below, never from above. And the whole project of the euro was bound to shatter apart, and it is shattering. But by God, the military alliance is not shattering. What we now have is a Tory Britain freed to resume its relations with America. You cannot simply counterpose one imperialist project to another and say, hail the liberation of the British people. I don't agree with that. What we have is a very difficult situation, a genuine fracturing, in which our task is, out of the ruin that is coming, to be able to fight with great resolution for what is just and for the way out. But I am sorry, I respectfully differ from the idea that this is some great moment of national liberation of the British people.
This afternoon on CBC, I heard the new head of the Tory party, May, she spoke, and I have never heard a more left-wing speech by a Tory in my life. It was profoundly left-wing in the most unprecedented way. And why did that happen? It happened because underlying it all is the emergence of Jeremy Corbyn and the fear that in this crisis, Corbyn will rise. And I believe that that is that is the way things are going to go. In response to this crisis, I think that there is every hope that faced with the difficulties that they're going to experience, the British people will turn to the left. I'm not writing guarantees on this, but I'm thinking that that's well the way things might go. And also, I'd like to echo Alan in saying, of course, the Britain for Britons, and the idea that you can go back to a national, you know, the 19th century, and that kind of that kind of politics is inconceivable. It's completely regressive. And what we need is obviously one of the roots of the crisis that we're in on a global scale is the fact that in fact, there is no institutional framework for moving the global economy forward in terms of creating a context in which all the peoples of the world are going to share the wealth of this world. And that, at some level, is at the root of why the world has fallen into the crisis. So we have to fight politically for a new internationalism in which is going to be profoundly democratic rather than regressive and going back to the old nationalism. That's
okay. I'm going to cut this comment. Must you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Enough just to go savage
ahead.
Me.
All right. All right. I'm glad we've had this exchange, but I don't want it to go on forever.
I just want to make a quick comment, and that is my main reason for supporting Britain's move to leave Europe is that it will weaken NATO. Our big concern right now is a probability of nuclear war between America and the Soviet and Russia. And there's a good possibility that Warsaw Conference that they had was absolutely bizarre and crazy. It was devoid of any, they didn't relate to reality. It was all ideology. It was Russia who caused the breakup in Ukraine. Russia stole, they marched in and they took Crimea by military force. Meantime, what do you think would happen in Canada if a government came in and suddenly outlawed French as an official language? And the next move was to take away their provincial rights. How long would it be before Quebec would leave? Well, that's exactly what the fascist new regime in Ukraine did with regard to Crimea. They outlawed Russian as an official language. Meantime, 60% of the people are Russian. They were part of Russia as long as America is in existence. And they were going to take away their autonomy. And so they voted in a referendum, and we're all saying they didn't have a right to vote. Well, damn it, the United Nations has a provision in the Charter giving a distinct group of people the right to determine self-determination. Over 80% of the people turned out to vote. 95% of them wanted to leave Ukraine and join Russia. And so Putin and Russia agreed to let them in. Anyway, if this weakens NATO, and the possibility, will lessen the possibility of war. That's my main concern here. The Brits can look after themselves.
Okay, we will have all kinds of issues here. If you have something to say, a question to raise, please stand up and speak very loudly so the rest of us can hear.
I guess my question to the panel is, do you guys see the Brexit movement leading to an economic shift in global power led by the BRICS alliance?
Alan has covered a large part of the ways in which Brexit is breaking down the hitherto closely related three imperialisms. In a sense, actually, the a word about the BRICS, I prefer the term emerging economies. And then within them, I would say that China, you have to say China is a class apart. It's definitely completely different. I was at a conference not long ago where a colleague of mine, Paul Kellogg, said that what we have witnessed in China over the last three or four decades is the greatest industrial revolution in the world. Not the first, not anything, you know, whatever. It's the biggest in terms of the sheer numbers of people who have been involved. And I don't think that it was possible in any ordinary capitalist country. It is the fact that it is ruled by a communist party that plans the economy. No matter how many capitalists are operating in China, it still has a planning structure. Without a proper planning, this kind of industrial revolution would simply not have been possible. So I would say that. And so to me, again, this is part of a longer-term process in which the structures of imperialism that have been in place since essentially the 19th century are breaking down. And what will take its place? I'm not suggesting that there is no potential for these emerging economies dominating other economies, weaker economies. It can happen. But the very fact that productive capacity is now even more widely spread around the world means that the capacity of any one power to dominate others is actually correspondingly less. So I'm not going to say, oh, the Russians and the Chinese are cute and cuddly. No, I don't have to say that. There are more countervailing forces, do you see? And also the more productive capacity spreads around the world, the more difficult it becomes to dominate any country. You know, let me just give a small... I hate this analogy, but I haven't been able to think of a better one. Imagine an abusive father who beats up his little kids. Well, the kid doesn't have to become as big as his father in order for that to stop. He just has to become big enough for his father to have to count the cost of beating him up. Do you see? And I think that that sort of change is going on. The United States today, contrary to what some people may think, and there are many, United States is certainly not, certainly trying as best as it can to hide it, trying to show that it's still big daddy all over the world, etc. But actually, it has also had to draw in its claws to a very significant extent. So I think that that has been a good thing. So I would say that in terms of the imperial structures, this would change. And I think the fact that Germany joined the AIIB, so many Western countries have joined, plus the UK joined. I think the UK's joining is probably in some ways even more significant because of the role of the City of London. That is to say, the financial sector. It's a bit like saying Bay Street in Toronto. That's what the City of London means, not the actual city. So the financial sector in London actually has always seen itself as the cutting edge of, you know, where financial activity is. And basically, it has had to admit that the kind of short-term destructive capital flows that it has helped the United States to spread around the world over the last two or three decades, their time is gone. Now you have a new type of capital flows that are now coming from China on completely different terms. China is not asking for conditionalities. China is not asking for structural adjustment. China is not saying you must lift capital controls if you wish to have our capital, so that our capital, finicky and fickle as it is, will come in and go out as it pleases, causing crisis in your country. China is actually saying we will invest long-term in infrastructure, in industry, etc. This is a completely different game. It's a completely different game. We can talk a lot more about this as well, but I just would say, yeah.
I think what we can look forward in the next little while is how both Russia and China are going to respond to the crack-ups that we see developing in the European Union. And I think that there we could see some very interesting shifts and maneuvers, including what the English financial class, how they respond to the crisis they find themselves in now, and even in terms of their relationship with Russia and indeed China. And so there is that. I guess I'll leave it at that.
We just heard the panel discussion, How Brexit Changes Everything, convened at the Millennium Library in downtown Winnipeg on July 13th, 2016. The event was organized by Canadian Dimension magazine. A full video can be found along with this radio program by visiting the website globalresearch.ca and clicking the tab Global Research News Hour and looking for the entry, How Brexit Changes Everything. Many thanks to Canadian Dimension for allowing us to record and broadcast this talk. Canadian Dimension's website is canadiandimension.com. Feel free to send your feedback to globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. My name is Michael Welch. Thank you for joining us.